Some examples are, again, the families that made their fortune in the opium trade. And you got to remember, the opium trade meant going from India, which was under British domination, to China, where the British were attempting to open up an opium market, and indeed fought wars to do that. So these are the families whose family fortunes go back precisely to that trade.
Then you've got a newer element which arose in the 1870s, the money element, like the Harrimans. His father was E.H. Harriman, the railroad magnate. So the core, as you go through the early 20th century, is comprised of 15 or 20 families, partially from old line American families going back to the Pilgrims, and partially from money, banking money, that came up through the late 19th century.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show. I trust you've been listening to Richie Allen on this stream. At least we hope he's on this stream. There seem to be some problems with his own website today. Before we started, that is from 3 p.m. today and every Friday, I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. Again, is Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. In the second part, Finian Cunningham on the peace deal. Ethiopia's Nobel Peace Prize winning Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed did with the dictator of neighbouring Eritrea, with which his country was at war, only to bring the Eritrean troops and mercenaries into Ethiopia after the peace deal to kill his own people. Ethiopia resident, former Fleet Street sub-editor, recently having fled Tigray, where he was living, Finian Cunningham joins us for an exclusive update on what's going on in Northeast Africa. And crooks at home and abroad. Our Tory Labour mayor, Bristol's Marvin Rees, refuses to argue for less strict measures for Bristol's struggling businesses and people, embracing Tier 3 set down by the government and Boris Johnson, which begins next week, with open arms. Rather than admitting COVID-19 has virtually disappeared from Bristol, he opens a new test centre in South Bristol, desperate to find bits of shredded DNA in our bodies, which our bodies have killed off long ago, using the PCR test to justify destroying Bristolians' lives and livelihoods. Tonight we have on the line, joining me from Hong Kong live, it's Robert Hanson. Hi Robert, welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi Tony, thank you for the welcome.
Now Robert, just tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you wind up as a Brit in Hong Kong? Were you born there?
No, I wasn't. I met a girl in London when I was actually working in London, who was from Hong Kong, and I moved to Hong Kong, married her, and have been living mainly out of Hong Kong for most of the past 10 years, with just occasional visits back to my hometown in Yorkshire.
Now, last year we had 2 million people on the streets in Hong Kong, massive protests, all sorts of, like, you know, smashing up of various government buildings, this sort of thing, even though, you know, you're sitting there thinking, crikey, you've got an enormous great barracks full of Chinese soldiers just across the road. What if they were to decide to come out? But now everything's changed, hasn't it?
Yeah, there is no protests at all, and what they were actually protesting to stop has actually been put into law. So in essence, the government's got exactly what it wanted. It's got the national security law, it's got no protests, and people have just fallen into line. And that's really because of two things. First, the COVID hoax or COVID reality. And secondly, the national security law itself, which has potential life sentences if you try to undermine the Chinese authorities by calling for things like independence or other ways of undermining their authority. So it's quite a very hostile and harsh.
I mean, how does the law work? Are you allowed to talk about people who might be calling for independence? Is that different to calling for independence yourself?
Oh, gosh. I mean, you can report that such and such was calling for independence, because there are cases on national security law now. So they are reporting X was calling for this, and this is why he's facing a criminal trial.
Yeah, so,
you can report on it, but
so you can say it, but you're not allowed to. You can say someone else has said it, but you're not allowed to say it yourself. Sounds like we're going on a really kind of very peculiar route here. But actually, people haven't fallen into line, have they? They've been pushed into line, really.
They've been pushed into line, but there is a genuine fear, real or imagined, about this the COVID virus, and that really stems from the SARS outbreak in Hong Kong. I think it was about 2003 when about 299 people died with SARS. So the Hong Kong people are particularly sensitive to respiratory diseases like COVID. So they've really fallen in line with wearing the masks. They abide by what's called the social distancing rule, don't gather in groups of more than four. So that really has kept people in line, and the police are strictly enforcing that. So if there are gatherings of more than four, the police are onto it straight away.
I suppose using things like CCTV and things like that. Well, look, we're going to be talking in a bit about what's happening in the UK, but I just want to get it established first. What about travel restrictions? Say, for example, from the UK, can we fly in and out of Hong Kong? What happens if we do, if we try? Can we transit through Hong Kong? Can you go from Hong Kong to mainland China? And what happens if you try to do that?
Right. If you travel from the UK to Hong Kong at the moment, you'd have to spend 14 days in quarantine in a hotel, which you'd have to pay for yourself. And on arrival at the airport, you'd be forced to take a test. And if the test proved negative at the airport, well, so you go straight to the hotel, you spend 14 days in the hotel, then you have another test, and then you can be released. And everybody has to do that coming into Hong Kong. There have been notable exceptions. Lord Sumption, who's been in the British news, I think, about discussing the COVID restrictions, he flew into Hong Kong and was exempted from any form of quarantine. And he judged a case out here and then flew straight back to the UK, I think, before embarking on a cycling tour in France and then another trip to Italy. So the restrictions apply to normal people, but special people are exempted from it.
So how do you get to become a special person?
It's kind of who the government likes, really. So government employees, Chinese officials, and prominent business people are exempted. But for the 99.999% of the population, everybody, even if you're a Hong Kong resident and you leave, you come back to Hong Kong, you've got to spend 14 days in quarantine.
I suppose the other obvious question is, what happens if you test positive?
Then you would go to a quarantine centre and be monitored in the quarantine centre. So it would not be as comfortable as a hotel.
And of course, this is taking place for people even who don't have any symptoms. I mean, how does this, do you think, fit in to the, in a way, I think of Hong Kong as kind of being at the front line between the West and China, this kind of debacle going on for the last, well, probably decades, actually. And I wonder how this has fitted into that. You've been saying so far that it sounds like China has just completely got their way and Hong Kong is now officially part of China. But there is still some separation, isn't there?
There is, but that separation is narrowing by the day. There was the chief executive's annual address this week, and she made it very clear that she wants to integrate Hong Kong to the Greater Bay Area of China. So there's more merging of China and Hong Kong. And I think the current chief executive, Carrie Lam, is in a very, very weak position, because following all the riots last year, she's been really propped up by Beijing and really controlled by Beijing. So she has to jump exceptionally high to their commands and their tunes, which is to integrate Hong Kong more and more into China. And you can feel that. You can really feel that on the ground. And I think there's something like 2,000 families have relocated to England under this special BNO scheme. I know it doesn't come in force until January, but people have gone across already because they can actually stay in the UK for 6 months on their Hong Kong passport as it is. And then I think they will apply for this 5-year special deal to stay in England.
And what about you and your own friends? Have you been thinking about maybe leaving Hong Kong? And if so, why?
Oh, gosh. I mean, this is a really tricky situation because obviously my wife is from Hong Kong. I don't want to have a vaccination whatsoever. So if this vaccination is going to become mandatory, you've really got to decide what's going to be your final destination because you're not going to be able to travel to another country without a vaccination. So, oh, gosh, it's kind of concerning times. When I came to Hong Kong, I really, really, really enjoyed Hong Kong. It was one of the freest yet safest places in the world. And I love the temperature, the climate out here.
Well, Robert, you say that, but actually it was pretty much a British dictatorship, wasn't it?
It was, but they were hands off.
It wasn't a democracy.
It certainly was not a democracy. Chris Patten, the last governor, like all the previous governors, were appointed. So in a sense, the appointment of Carrie Lam isn't any different. I mean, you know, Hong Kong has never been a democracy. But the difference is Britain wasn't too bothered about what Hong Kong people got up to. It was just interested in using it as a money-making machine and was very much hands-off and didn't really dictate the little parts of everybody's life, whereas the Beijing authorities want to, you know, dictate what you can say, what you can write, and probably bring in, so I think we'll bring in social credit in eventually into Hong Kong. So they're more controlling than what the Brits were. So it's true, neither were a democracy, but democracy and freedom are not the same thing. I think that's a big mistake people make, democracy and freedom. They're different. In Hong Kong, you had a great deal of freedom but no democracy. Now you've got restricted freedom and no democracy.
Martin Summers, I'd just like to bring you in on this because it's a bit of a dilemma, isn't it? I mean, it does seem as if the people in Hong Kong are in that situation where, you know, they're going to have to jump at some point and they may decide one way or the other, but they're certainly getting nervous about this restriction on, it's basically free speech, which is the main thing right now. But then you've got all sorts of things like surveillance and social credit systems, systems of control, which, you know, sort of demote you as a citizen if you don't obey, don't behave yourself, this sort of thing coming over the horizon. So can you see why some people like Robert and his, you know, maybe some of his acquaintances, obviously there's quite a lot of people thinking of coming to live in the UK already?
Well, yes. I mean, it's a very tense situation, as has just been explained. And of course, when obviously for our colleague here, who's married to a person from Hong Kong, he's got British citizenship anyway. He could come back and bring his wife with him. But of course, there's got to be special arrangements for native Chinese Hong Kong. And of course, that doesn't actually. I mean, the government has just won a referendum on Brexit and a majority of 80 in the House of Commons for ending free movement into Britain. And if thousands or possibly millions of Hong Kong Chinese turn up, that's going to be a bit of a problem.
Is it possible it might be millions, do you think, Robert?
Difficult. And I don't think it's going to be millions because I think there's only maximum of about 500,000 who are eligible under the BNO scheme to actually come across. And I think there's a reason why they're targeting Hong Kong, I think the British government, because the people coming across are likely to be very wealthy and likely to be quite highly educated. So you're getting probably a good workforce, if you want to be quite cynical about it. It's okay. About bringing money into Hong Kong, into the UK, and about bringing quite well-educated people into the UK, as opposed to, say, maybe people from poorer countries who may be not as wealthy and, say, a liability on the state, if you're talking financial terms, whereas the Hong Kong people, you know, an average apartment out here for a middle-class person would be up at least £1 million.
Okay, so what we're talking about really is not importing cheap labour to undermine existing jobs and paying conditions in the UK, something a bit different.
Yeah, you're talking about bringing in multilingual, wealthy people that work very hard, work very, very long hours compared to the UK, and would be ideal employees for any employer.
Now, you just don't...
I think the UK government's realised that, because they've got obviously the British Chamber of Commerce over here, the British Consul over here, and there are university reunions, and you know they've got a very targeted group of people that will take up this offer and come to England, and so I think they see it as an upgrading of the workforce, if you like.
You're talking about mandatory vaccination potentially coming from China, but surely even before that, this is coming, it's coming from Qantas, it's coming from Australia. You know, the airlines saying, oh, well, you won't be able to get on a Qantas plane until you've had the vaccine, even though there isn't a vaccine yet.
That's the scary thing, because it means if someone like me does not want to have the vaccine, you've got to make a very serious choice. Do you want to spend the rest of your days in Hong Kong, or do you want to spend the rest of your days in the UK? Because it won't just be Qantas. Qantas Airlines are partners with British Airways, Japan Airlines, and also the Hong Kong airline, Cathay Pacific. Those are the big airlines, plus 30 other airlines. Now, a couple of years ago, I went to Australia, and we got a late-night flight back, and it was supposed to be Cathay Pacific, but it ended up merging the Qantas flight with the Cathay Pacific flight with the Iberia passengers as well, all on one aeroplane. So if Qantas have mandatory vaccination and they're part of an alliance, I would say that just about every company will have mandatory vaccination before you can fly.
I suppose you could always go by boat. So it might be take a bit longer.
It would take longer. I mean, also, I think I just let you know, I'm still in contact with my MP from Shipley, Mr. Philip Davies.
Oh, yes, so you got a letter from him, didn't you? So can you just tell us what's in that?
I've had quite a few, actually. I've got another one today.
I think that's funny, because his own constituencies find it difficult for him to get a reply out of him, but you've managed to get a reply all the way over there in Hong Kong. Amazing. Well done.
I'm still linked to Shipley, so this is why he's still technically my MP. And in his email he put, I was concerned about being people facing restrictions if they didn't have a vaccine. And I sent him a copy of a letter that had been posted on some websites from Nadine Dorries, who said that if you do not choose to take a vaccination, you will face restrictions to stop yourself infecting other people, right? So I asked Philip Davies about this, and he said, I don't know if the letter you've sent me is genuine or not, but nothing in it is a surprise. I think there has always been an obvious that whilst taking the vaccine will not be compulsory, people will be encouraged to take it in other ways. For example, I think it's pretty obvious that people will be told that if you want to go on holiday or attend a football match, etc., etc., you will have had to have had the vaccine. That is what the letter is driving at.
Well, it's interesting,
you know,
we're talking about the vaccine, though, but, you know, there's all sorts of different vaccines being developed out there. Hearing more about exaggerations made by AstraZeneca about the Oxford vaccine today in the news. But I'd just like to have a listen, if you don't mind, for a few minutes to the chat we had on last week's Dr. Stanley Laham from University of Florida, who is a lifelong immunologist, worked there as well. But he had some interesting things to say last week about the mRNA vaccine. So this is very different to what they call an attenuated vaccine, which is basically COVID-19, but it looks to your body like COVID-19, but like a traditional vaccine, like cowpox, smallpox, or whatever, it's actually not able to make you anywhere near as ill as the actual COVID-19. So your body is kind of trained, really, by this attenuated vaccine. Anyway, these mRNA vaccines are very, very different. And he had all sorts of interesting things to say also on the longer piece, which is available up on our website at thisweek.org.uk, the full interview, which we didn't play last week. So here he is now talking about the mRNA vaccine and why it is that Moderna, the company who are one of the two companies along with Pfizer, that are trying out this type of vaccine at the moment, why is that they have never, ever produced anything which has actually been sold on the medical markets before. So they're basically a kind of research and development company that are getting loads of money over the years from various hedge funds on the hope that they will get something which will they'll be able to sell to the market, which is, I find incredible, the idea that we would be taking a vaccine potentially from a company that's never actually produced anything for the market before. It's only ever been used as a place for speculators to do research and development. But anyway, here's Dr. Stanley Laham from University of Florida again now.
Well, it's obviously a much faster track. With the gene manipulation techniques that we have now, it's very easy to identify that spike protein RNA, cleave it out, put it in what they call a liposome, and inject it into the body. You don't have to try to put it into another virus, or you don't try to attenuate the coronavirus itself. It's a real fast-track way of having the body produce an immune response against that spike protein. And it's another way to, if I may say so, to have a new patent. And as you know, whether it's Moderna or Pfizer, their stock prices are shooting up in the stock exchanges. As a matter of fact, there was an article that, you know, Moderna has not produced any pharmaceutical at all. It's not that they haven't produced a vaccine before. They haven't produced any drug that's been on the market. Yet as soon as they announced their mRNA vaccine and that they were on a fast track, they were approved on a fast track to produce that vaccine, their stocks, shot up by hundreds of millions of dollars. And it seems that some of the high executives, before their vaccine was proven, I'm talking about three months ago, sold their stocks. So cashed in before they had a proven vaccine or... But that's the way the new... I guess it's an example of what Naomi Klein called disaster capitalism.
In what way?
In a way that, a lot of epidemics, natural disasters and stuff like this are an occasion or an opportunity for some companies to make a lot of money. And we've seen that with the history of coronavirus since the beginning. The approval, for example, the criticism of certain drugs that were shown in vitro in scientific articles published in Nature and Lancet to have antiviral properties to inhibit the coronavirus, that were denounced as fraudulent, as quackery, while remdesivir was being lauded as an effective drug against coronavirus, which it is not. It has not saved lives. The best study they had is that, it retarded by 3 days the stay in hospital of patients. It lessened by 3 days hospital stays. Remdesivir is, whereas drugs like ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine have been shown in vitro to seriously inhibit both extracellularly and intracellularly the coronavirus. And they are very safe drugs. It was amazing. To me, I was amazed back in February and March when everybody was warning, what? Hydroxychloroquine is dangerous, you know, for the heart, that it can cause terrible heart conditions. It's unsafe. A drug that's 75 years old, that hundreds of millions of people have taken, and that has saved tens of millions of lives, that was on the list of the United Nations essential drugs for humanity. We never heard about any dangers of it, you know, for the cardiovascular system, until it was used for the coronavirus outbreak. The other drug that has proven effective is another anti-parasitic drug, ivermectin, which has shown in vitro within 48 hours, if you had infected tissue cultures that you treated, that you put in the nutrient fluid of these tissue cultures, ivermectin, and infected them with the Corona 2 COVID-19 virus, and a group of controls that did not have ivermectin that you're infected with the coronavirus, these tissue cultures would be totally destroyed by the coronavirus, whereas those with the ivermectin, there would be no effect and no coronavirus RNA detectable.
Well, that's pretty incredible, really. Dr. Stanley Laham again, Martin, from last week, really emphasizing, I mean, it's interesting to hear, I think, you know, medical professional, someone who spent his life as an immunologist in Florida and other parts of the world, by the way, saying, actually, this is about disaster capitalism.
Well, I think that's common ground, actually. Whatever you think about the virus and about vaccines, the production of vaccines under that political economy that he just basically put his finger on is the problem. And, of course, other vaccines are being developed elsewhere. For example, in Cuba, they've got two of their own vaccines for COVID, which they've developed entirely independently of Western Big Pharma. And, you know, there isn't just one dog in this game.
Well, Robert Hansen's joining us live from Hong Kong. Robert, what do you make of that? He's saying really effectively there that, that there's a lot of money being staked on this. It's almost like some kind of casino table. And also that the company Moderna and Pfizer, the vaccine they're producing, Moderna has never produced anything that's gone to market before. This is basically a kind of stack of chips on a roulette table that has never produced anything before. Maybe it's I'm trying to stretch a point here, but it's like one of the numbers that's never come up. Moderna are hoping it's going to come up for them this time.
I mean, none of that actually surprises me. I think it's also been reported in the press quite widely that the chief executive officer of Pfizer sold his shares, didn't he, once the drug had got approval and the share price rocketed. That tends to suggest that, you know, the profit's already been made on the potential, and maybe the potential is not there, or perhaps there's something down the line that might cause difficulties, because if you were holding shares in a company that you thought would do very well in the future, you wouldn't sell those shares, however wealthy you were, unless you really needed the cash. And from what I gather, he didn't need the cash, and I think that should send a warning that things might not be that great with the Pfizer vaccine.
I mean, Martin, this does remind me a little bit of what Chris Busby was saying a few months ago, another doctor, about what's been going on down at Hinkley Point with this massive amount of investment in Somerset going into nuclear power, whereas it may be in a few years down the line that the British government simply doesn't have the money to invest in all the subsidies that are necessary to make that nuclear power financially viable, and that maybe these companies like Moderna and like Hinkley Point, people constructing that, are simply looking to make money with this kind of dream dangling ahead of them, and then at the last minute, when they realise the whole thing is not viable, they're going to pull out and go bankrupt and run away with the cash.
Yeah, it's a fairly common practice. And of course, what's happened with the Pfizer chief executive is he took an option on selling the shares, some months ago when the shares of the company were quite low, and he said, I'll sell them at the low price that we've got now, and I'll buy them, you know, he basically showed that he knew in advance when they were going to make the, it's basically insider trading. And it's not unusual. It is disaster capitalism because we live in a regime of disaster capitalism.
Well, is there any reason why? I mean, we've been living into this weird quantitative easing world, haven't we? Really, since 2008, where the real economy is shrinking and the financialized economy is growing all the time. And most of the money that the Bank of England is printing is simply going into pumping up assets.
Yes, I mean, it's always been there. But, of course, the bailout of the banks in 2008 was the big daddy of them all. And what's happened is the QE has just been used by chief executives to buy back their own shares, which increases their own bonuses. And at the same time, the real economy is gradually being starved to death. In actual fact, it's not like a parasite on the real economy. It's killing the real economy. And ultimately, you know, we're talking about what's going to happen going forward. I think at some point, you know, some derivatives trade is going to bring down the whole market like it did in 2008. But they'll walk away with the cash and leave the society as a whole with the bill.
Well, how's this looking from Hong Kong, all this financial future, Robert?
Hong Kong is still financially very secure. I mean, the current chief executive's been running budget deficits, but overall, the government's got money in the bank. And most people in Hong Kong have pretty good savings.
I mean, sorry to interrupt you, Robert, but Martin, could it be that China and the East is quite solid financially, and actually the West is what's really shaky and goes down?
Well, I mean, it's possible that it's so interconnected that a major catastrophe in the Western financial markets won't leave China unaffected. But, of course, they've just signed this free trade agreement. All the Southeast Asian countries, including Japan and Australia and New Zealand, but excluding India, they were invited to join in, but they didn't. And all of these countries have, in fact, you know, because of the internal measures they've adopted, they haven't got serious lockdowns going on because they crushed the virus in the early stages. And the Chinese economy is going to be the biggest growth pole in the world this year, even though they were not forsook by the virus in the beginning of the year. So, I mean, you know, this is big changes in the geopolitical balance of power.
But one of the things which would also make those share prices in the vaccine firms do really well, Robert, is if there, if there was no cure. But it turns out with COVID-19, it does look like there is something which you probably can't call it a cure, but something which can save a lot of people. This very cheap drug called hydroxychloroquine or chloroquine, which has been around for a long time, Stanley was talking about there. And The Lancet published a study in June 2020, or actually May, I believe. And then in June, it had to withdraw the study because it found that the people that had written it, which was criticizing hydroxychloroquine, had made figures up, and that actually the study, even though it had managed to get into The Lancet, was completely inaccurate. So I suppose that would affect these share prices too. If something like chloroquine comes along, suddenly their share prices and all the money that's been poured into a vaccine looks less viable.
Yeah, but there's also really the bit that really annoys me more than anything else is that, again, I'm going to quote from Philip Davies here when he spoke in Parliament, and he points out that in a meeting he had with Professor Whitty, the overall mortality rate from COVID is thought to be between 0.4 and 1%, probably 0.7%. So given that is such a very low mortality, and given what we know about the average death rates and also the way people have been classed as COVID deaths if they died within 28 days, I don't think, it doesn't appear to me to be a big problem here. There's certainly one, not that one that requires a vaccine, all these lockdowns. Given those figures that even Professor Whitty's accepting as being accurate, of the thought of someone dying is between 0.4 and 1% from COVID. This is crazy. And I think, as what Philip Davies actually went on to say, he said, the current approach is like a health expert saying they can eliminate all road deaths each year by banning anyone from ever using their car. and the government agreeing to it. It's crazy.
Okay, well, you say it's crazy, but obviously the government is saying it's deadly serious. I thought we'd just review some of the government policy on this since March and start with Boris back on I think it's the 16th of March, this speech, roughly there anyway, when he announced the very first lockdown. This is March 2020, when a three-week lockdown was announced by Boris Johnson. He made this statement.
I can assure you that we will keep these restrictions under constant review. We will look again in 3 weeks and relax them if the evidence shows we are able to. But at present, there are just no easy options. The way ahead is hard, and it is still true that many lives will sadly be lost. And yet it is also true that there is a clear way through. Day by day, we are strengthening our amazing NHS with 7,500 former clinicians now coming back to the service. With the time you buy by simply staying at home, we are increasing our stocks of equipment. We are accelerating our search for treatments. We're pioneering work on a vaccine. And we are buying millions of testing kits that will enable us to turn the tide on this invisible killer.
So that's Boris Johnson and his big speech, where he dropped the idea of having herd immunity and decided to go for the lockdowns back in March this year. And then I think let's skip back to October. We had Halloween, didn't we? The 31st of October, with that fascinating timing for Boris's speech, actually on a Saturday evening, just as the Halloween moon was rising behind him. Now, Chris Whitty, Martin, you were complaining that you weren't getting enough pro-lockdown scientists. Well, he, of course, is the chief scientist, Britain's chief scientist. I like to think of him, well, I don't like to think of him, but I do think of him as the love child of Voldemort and Gollum of some sort. He's got this kind of very strange, he looks like one of those creatures out of the Lord of the Rings that's somehow mutated. But anyway, he's got loads of great credentials, mainly from the private pharmaceutical industry. But here he is speaking back on Halloween, talking with Boris. But we're just going to hear from Chris Whitty now about why we needed this extra, what they call lockdown light, or the Halloween lockdown.
The idea that there is some perfect time to act is a complete misapprehension. There is basically no perfect time, and there are no good solutions. All the solutions are bad, and what we're trying to do is have the fewest, you know, the least bad set of solutions at a time which you actually achieve the kind of the balance that needs to be struck between all these things that ministers have to make decisions on. And in terms of making festivities, whether it's Christmas or any other religious tradition, we would have a much better chance of doing it with these measures than we would if these measures were not being taken today.
Yeah, so that's Chris Whitty there speaking back on Halloween. And once he'd finished his talk, Boris also told us that he thought that we had to have a lockdown at Halloween if we wanted to have basically go back to normal for Christmas. So let's have a listen to Boris now, but also talking on Halloween.
Is the period up to the 2nd of December going to be enough? I hope so. We have every reason to believe it will be, but we will be driven by the science, and we will look at where we've got to. You know, I'm optimistic because as I said a couple of weeks ago, and I said again tonight, you know, the R, although it's above one, is not that much above one. I think you looking at one of the slides that Patrick showed us earlier, you know, it has been coming down. The trouble is that still means that the disease is doubling. If we can get it below one, then, as you know, it starts halving, and that's where we want to get. And we think this package will do that, but we will be led by the evidence.
And then we had the 4 weeks of the Halloween lockdown, the lockdown light, lockdown number two, where actually, amazingly, I didn't see any change really in the amount of traffic on the roads. So I don't quite know whether people were actually really locking down or not. Certainly loads of traffic about. And then we had, this week, we had the announcement of the various Christmas measures by Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, and he talked about what is his winter plan.
Across the whole of the UK, measures remain in place to control the virus. Under our winter plan, England will return to a tiered system of local restrictions. Our decisions on which area enters which tier are based on public health advice according to five indicators. Cases across all ages, especially the over 60s, the rate by which cases are rising or falling, the percentage of those tested in a local population who have COVID, and the pressure on the NHS. We're publishing data packs setting out the reasons behind the decisions in each area. To find out how this affects you, log on to gov.uk, where all the information is available. I'm sorry to confirm that from Wednesday, most of England will be in the top two tiers with the toughest measures. And I know that this will bring a great deal of heartache and frustration, especially for our vital hospitality sector, our pubs, our restaurants, our hotels, in so many ways the soul of our communities, and which continue to bear a disproportionate share of the burden. I really wish it were otherwise, but if we're going to keep schools open, as we must, then our options in bearing down on the disease are necessarily limited.
Okay, so that's Boris Johnson speaking. Martin, one of the things that is a pattern here is in all the speeches, he's saying, oh, once the lockdown's finished, I'm very optimistic, everything will be looking good. Sorry, for example, in the very first one, once 3 weeks are up, we will relax them, dot, 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 if. And then it's always, what we're always told after the event is, oh, I'm so sorry, we're not going to be able to relax them. It almost seems like a kind of confidence trick, a rolling confidence trick, this.
Well, I think the obvious thing that people are noting about this is that Boris doesn't really know what he's talking about, whatever your views on coronavirus and vaccines. The fact is, he's flip-flopped
all
over.
But he's following the medical advice from Chris Whitty, Patrick Vallance.
Yeah, but when Cummings was on the SAGE committee, which we'd only found out through investigation because he's a SPAD, he's not supposed to be on the committee, he was the one who said, well, let's just have a fling with this, and we'll be an outlier, and we'll go for herd immunity. He denies it, but we've got people who are in the meeting who reported it to the Times, and I think it was the Telegraph, that's what he'd said.
Well, I would hope they had considered it, at least.
Yeah, but he's not supposed to be on the committee. Don't forget, he's not a scientist. He's a history graduate, and he shouldn't have been there in the first place. There he is, and in fact, because he's directly connected to the Prime Minister, it looks like he intimidated everybody else, and they basically backed down. Then, of course, they changed tack and say we've got to have a lockdown. But I mean, lots of people, and there's going to be a public inquiry into this sooner or later. Lots of people who've lost family and already are saying we should have had one already.
Do you think, like Belarus, Britain was offered money by the IMF to lock down?
No, I don't think so. I think what was happening is they were more obsessed with Brexit, which was their big, that's the most important thing. Global Britain required keeping Britain open for business because that's part of the ideology of Brexit.
We've got a couple more clips in a minute, but Robert Hanson from Hong Kong, what do you make of what you've heard there? I'm just a little bit concerned about the language that they're using. This whole idea of, oh, it's okay, everything will be fine if we do this. And then at the end of it, oh, well, I'm very sorry, we're going to have to, actually, in this case, we're going to have to make things much worse than they were before you had this Halloween lockdown. That is the case for Bristol, anyway.
Yeah, the impression I get is that they're just dragging this on until they can force everybody to have a vaccine. And I think that's the game in town. They want to keep people locked up, frustrated, batter them down, make them feel bad, and at the same time get the vaccine ready and then say, if you want to live normal, you've got to have the vaccine. Because earlier on, the vaccine wasn't ready, so they didn't want to let everybody out, because if everybody went out and there was no increase in this so-called COVID, then they wouldn't be able to promote the vaccine. But by keeping people locked up, it makes them say, well, I'll do anything, give me the vaccine. And also, it gives them time to make the vaccines. I think that those are the two things at play.
They just... There's another.
Yeah, they're just stringing people along.
Okay, yeah, I think maybe
not
right.
not just Boris, but also I think worse for me is Keir Starmer. I think he's the worst of the worst of the worst for a few reasons. First, he's a human rights Queen's Counsel barrister from Doughty Street Chambers. And he was Human Rights Queen's Counsel of the Year. That means the best, top of the pops, all singing, all dancing, superstar human rights barrister at the Bar of England and Wales. Now, as a human rights barrister, what he's doing and what he's supporting goes against human rights.
Martin, do you want to answer that?
Well, I mean, the propaganda about Starmer as being a human rights lawyer, he's a big cheese lawyer, you're right. But in actual fact, for example, if he was a human rights lawyer, you'd thought he'd had something to say about Julian Assange. But of course, he's right on the, he's basically an establishment figure. He's an alternative conservative prime minister in waiting, which is a bit of a nightmare for people like me in the Labour Party. But of course, it's a nightmare for Boris as well, because he's basically turning into, Billy Bunter, who's, going to be hoofed out of office by somebody. And Starmer is being groomed to be that person.
Robert?
Well, Starmer is, I mean, he was awarded the Queen's Counsel Human Rights Silk of the Year. So he was recognised by his fellow barristers, by all the law commentators, as being the very best human rights lawyer. I think he's more another Tony Blair, and he's going to be serious, serious trouble for the UK. I agree with what Martin was saying. He's not a real human rights lawyer as a normal human person would see a human rights lawyer. But within the establishment's eyes, he is the pinnacle, the perfect human rights lawyer, which is the opposite of real human rights.
Oh, my goodness. So it's like the world's turned upside down. But anyway, the other thing about this Christmas period we're being told is we're going to have a five-day holiday. I just had to laugh when I heard this. Running from December the 23rd until the 27th. So I'm glad I'm not doing the travel news on BBC 5 Live on December the 23rd or December the 27th, or trying to route the trains around. It almost seems, Martin, it almost seems deliberate, this, in order to force everybody onto the roads, everybody onto the buses, everybody onto the trains, all on one day.
Well, don't count your chickens. It may well by the time we get there, they may decide that they're not going to do it. That's how disorganised they are. And don't, and lots of people actually who feel frightened about it. I'm thinking of my parents, for example. It's possible that we won't get together over Christmas, whatever they say.
Well, isn't that
because people making their own decisions?
Isn't that part of the deal here, that people are going to think, well, this is too restrictive. It's going to be too nightmarish to try and travel everybody in the whole country on the same day. So we'll just stay at home.
Well, I think if you look at what's happened in Sweden, where they've had a sort of lockdown light, they are moving in the direction of tightening their regulations, because, you know, that seems to be the direction of travel. I mean, obviously, I'm sceptical about everything to do with this, to be honest. I don't necessarily, I mean, you know, underlying all of this is this whole idea of the Wuhan virus coming from China, and the fact that it may be, in fact, a biological warfare agent designed not to kill loads of people, but to mess up economic activity.
Well, that's an interesting angle. Robert, what do you make of that?
Where did the virus come from? I'm not sure. I think in today's press they were claiming it came from India. China was saying it came from India. But whatever happens, it has certainly screwed up global economies completely. And I think it is part of what's unfortunately termed the Great Reset. It's again, you hear people from the WEF saying this virus has provided the ideal opportunity to reset the whole economies of the world. And it seems that all the leaders, I think Justin Trudeau, Scott Morrison in Australia, Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand, Boris Johnson, have all actually used that phrase or very similar phrases. This is a great opportunity to do things differently. They see it as an opportunity, which again makes me think it's more planned, and as like a planned launched weapon by a global one world government, of which people from China will be part of, all those key people from China will be part of.
I mean, Martin Summers, I mean, surely that's impossible, that people from all over the world could be getting together to, you know, cook this whole thing up and force everybody into some kind of new financial system.
Well, I'm totally on board with the idea of the Great Reset. I mean, disaster capitalism often happens when like the Haiti earthquake. Some people suggest that that wasn't just a natural earthquake or whatever. But even if you have natural disasters, disaster capitalists always batten onto them and push. I mean, this agenda of the Great Reset has been around for quite a while. And they're just accelerating it as a result of what's happened. But the big counter to that in my mind is that in actual fact there is no lockdown in China, there is no lockdown in Vietnam, there is no lockdown in the Republic of China, there's no lockdown in South Korea, there's no lockdown in New Zealand. And all of these countries have signed up to this new, they must have been negotiating it for years, free trade agreement without the Americans. So the Transatlantic Pacific Partnership, which Trump withdrew from on the sort of make America first again principle. What's actually happened is that the Chinese have stepped into his shoes and they've basically organized everybody around the Chinese. It's going to be the Southeast Asia co-prosperity sphere, which the Japanese were fighting for in World War II, but it's going to be done under the auspices of the Chinese Communist Party.
Okay, now, Let's just finish. Go on, Harry.
I don't think that the idea that they're all in it together stands up. There's probably going to be a shooting war in the South China Sea.
Let's hear from Robert. Is that true that the restrictions are finished there?
Well, Hong Kong is part of China. It's one country, two systems, but it's still part of China, and there are restrictions here. And from what I can gather, in mainland China, certainly leaked videos coming out of two people testing positive at, I think, with the Shanghai airport, and then other people pushing to try to get out of the airport because they would have to do 14 days quarantine. So I think it suggests that some people are still in quarantine in mainland China. Of course, news doesn't come out very easily from there, but I don't think it's totally gone away in mainland China.
So just talk about this.
That's in a full-on lockdown.
Let's just talk about this this incident at Shanghai Airport. It sounds quite interesting because it's the sort of thing that, you know, you can imagine the Chinese government, maybe if a similar thing happened here, our government too, trying to suppress the idea that you've got people who are being told to isolate or testing positive, and then the people around them then say, right, well, we're not going to be locking down, so we're out of here. We're not going to be restrictive for 14 days. This whole idea of when you're testing positive, suddenly all of your friends, your neighbours or whatever get blighted by that. Of course, that's going to also, for many people, they're going to be thinking to themselves, well, I'm not going to have a test in that case if my life and everybody else around me is going to be affected.
Well, I think that's why New Zealand have actually gone and built some detention centres. And it was Jacinda Ardern has been, someone's put it on one of their Facebook pages, and she was saying that everybody in New Zealand's got to have a test, and if you don't have a test, we're going to take you to a detention center and you're going to stay there for 14 days until you have the test, and we'll keep you there for another 14 days until you have a test, and that's a pretty good incentive to have a test. That seemed to me like quite a dictator in Jacinda Ardern. She's seeming more communist than the Communist Party. I mean, that's quite strong, forcing somebody, a healthy person, to have a test. And if you don't have it, we're going to incarcerate you until you do have the test. That's the New Zealand policy.
What about over in Hong Kong and China now, though? Because I know you've got these apps that I think is, I'm maybe wrong, but you have to have the app on your phone when you're travelling around. Is that right?
You don't in Hong Kong, you don't have to have it. I think about 10,000 venues have joined the government's Leave Home Safe mobile app program. So what they've got on the door of a restaurant is a pad, and it's got a code on it. And when you go into the restaurant, you put your phone against the code. It records what time you arrive and what time you leave. And then if somebody tests positive in that restaurant at the time you were there, you will receive a notification that someone has tested positive.
And what does that mean?
I don't know, because this is quite new. This is not fully played out yet, but it's in place to say again, if you want to have forced vaccination or make sure everybody's vaccinated or control people, the fact is they know what time you went in, what time you left, and they can send you a message saying somebody else here was infected. You know, it's kind of tracking you down. And
but I mean, surely, look, Robert, that's what you're going to have to do. If you're going to have a track and trace, test and trace system, then you're going to have to keep track of people, otherwise it doesn't work.
That's correct. And what they're doing in, for example, in housing estates, where if one person tests positive, comes down with COVID-19, then they do actually quarantine the whole housing estate, which is kind of a bit scary. And another thing that's coming this week is the government has said that if you go to see a doctor and the doctor says you have to have a test and you refuse to have a test, you will be fined $25,000 and get 6 months in prison. $25,000 Hong Kong dollars is about £2,500 and a six-month prison sentence.
Good God. Well, I mean, people may well be avoiding their doctors as well. I mean, that's what's basically been happening here too, is that many people have been too afraid to visit their doctors or visit hospitals, knowing that if they get put into hospital, then they may never see their loved ones again.
Well, again, it takes you back to this virus closing down all economies, because all that you need is one person to test positive from a very unreliable test to essentially then quarantine everybody else who's been in the restaurant or at that venue at the same time as that person. So, you know, this could lock many, many people up, and just goes on and on and on and on. And what it is doing is people are very reluctant now to book a taxi in advance, because if the taxi driver tests positive, they know where you are. And I think it's this app thing is actually closing down the economy more than opening it up. It's been sold as sort of freeing the economy because, you know, and making things safer. But people are very aware that I don't want to spend 14 days in a quarantine. So,
yeah. I mean, the surveillance that's going on is also, I mean, it fits in very well, if you can say that, use that word, horribly in a way, with the whole social credit system in mainland China. Are they thinking about bringing that in Hong Kong? And how does that work, Robert?
Well, the social credit system in China is based on, if you, in very crude terms, if you please the government, you get brownie points, plus points, and if you annoy the government, you get minus points. So little things like crossing a road, even if there's no traffic around and there's a red man there, the camera will capture you, and within a few seconds, you'll get negative social credit points. If you marry the right person, you'll get positive social credit points. If you do the right kind of job, you get positive. If you do drop some litter, you'll get negative. And if you've got negative social credit points, you can't travel, you can't buy certain goods, and so it restricts what you can do until you get your credit up to a high level. Now, with the virus and all these little machines you've got going into shops, it makes it easier. That, in effect, is a starting point in Hong Kong for social crediting, because it's control and monitoring.
So tell us about these machines when you're going into shops. You're talking about restaurants there, but you're saying that you've got to kind of have a little discussion with the machine before you're allowed in and out of a shop.
No, it's there's a person stood at the door, and then there's like a computer screen, and you just put your phone against that, and then it tells you the time you arrived, and then when you leave, it tells you the time you left.
So you have to have a phone, you know, with you, with the battery charged up before you're allowed to go into a shop. Is that what you're saying?
For some restaurants, yes, but I rarely eat out these days. I just don't want to eat out, because I don't want to be in a position where I could face 14 days quarantine. I don't want to put myself in that position. So that in itself has restricted what I go and do. But the other thing you have to do before you go into any shop is have a temperature check, and they spray your hands with gel. That happens as well.
Well, I mean, that actually seems to me the most sensible thing I've heard. The temperature check is probably the best indication, but even better than having a PCR test, as to whether you're actually ill and whether you're transmitting this COVID, if it's still around, or whether it's, you know, it might be you've just got a normal cold or a bit of a flu or something, or it could be all sorts of things that are giving you a temperature, but at least we know you're actually ill.
That's correct. I mean, temperature is one of the, for colds, for flus, for fevers, obviously is one of the more reliable, safe, nothing's 100%, but it's a very good indicator as to whether someone's ill or not. I mean, if you go to the doctors, in the good old days, they take your temperature, say, oh, he's got a fever, have a few days rest, take some vitamin C, take some pills or something, and you know you're ill. And also, I suppose it picks up flu and other things that you could spread to people. So I agree, temperature check to me is non-invasive, and not too much of a problem. But the rest of it, I really don't like the idea that if just one person tests positive, you could be quarantined. I think that's really, really horrible, actually. Yeah. And particularly the New Zealand, what New Zealand are doing, that's just worse than a dictator, this current New Zealand Prime Minister.
Well, what you mean, the idea of people having to go to a detention camp if they won't have a test?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, they want to test everybody, even the healthy people, not just the people.
Well, they're testing healthy people here. I mean, you know, there's loads of healthy people getting tested. In fact, we've just got a new test centre open. So more healthy people will be being tested.
But that's voluntary. That's voluntary. In New Zealand, it's compulsory. That's the difference. It's this compulsion to have the test.
And if you don't, Martin, what do you make of that?
Well, my ex-wife's just gone back to New Zealand for Christmas, and she had to spend 14 days in a hotel because she's a New Zealand citizen. She got a subsidised rate, but if you were going back as, you know, if you were travelling into New Zealand as a non-citizen, you'd have to pay for that hotel. There's just been a general election in New Zealand in which Jacinda Ardern has won an overall majority for the Labour Party on the back of what she's done on the COVID-19. And they've formed an alliance with the Green Party, and they're going to be firmly in power for the next 3 years. And, of course, Christmas in New Zealand is going to be absolutely as normal. Nobody's... Because they've had less than 100 deaths, and the country, the problem is people travelling in and out, but in actual fact, they've missed the bullet. And the population, some people in the National Party try to put it, you know, basically say that these measures are too extreme, etc., etc. And they were thoroughly thrashed at the election. So there you have it. That's the difference between that and New Zealand and Hong Kong.
Well, yes, but the National Party, I'm just reading here, this is in September, the National Party in New Zealand, which is the opposition, is calling for compulsory tests when people are in managed isolation. And quarantine facilities to be tested on day 3 of their stays. So it's only compulsory for testing on day 12 at the moment, and just before you leave.
So in other words, the opposition are taking a harder line than the government.
A bit like here in Britain, Robert.
Yeah. I don't like any of it. I just don't agree with any of this. I go back to the basics that, you know, the mortality rate is less than 0.7% of the people, and most of those would have died anyway. I think it's just trumped up and run by control freaks.
Okay, so let's get back to looking at what's happening in the UK, though, because most of us aren't actually over in New Zealand or in Hong Kong. And let's have a listen now to a continuation, really, of Boris's speech, where he announced earlier this week the measures of how to escape the tears. He's trying to offer us here a bit of a fig leaf, really, a bit like he did before in both of those other occasions we heard, where he's giving a speech saying, I'm very sorry about it, we're going to have to do another lockdown. But here is his little bit from this week about how to escape this awful tier system, how we can get out of it.
The allocation of tiers will be reviewed every 14 days, starting on the 16th of December. So your tier is not your destiny. Every area has the means of escape. And I have no doubt that together we can get through this winter, suppress the virus until vaccines come to our aid, and then reclaim our lives and all the things that we love.
Vaccines come to our aid, he's saying there, Robert. I think, you know, I tend to think that you may be right, because he's also holding up this idea of a vaccine as the knight in shining armour charging over the horizon towards us.
Yeah, and when you've got such a low death rate from this disease, and you're going to take a virtually new type of vaccine or relatively new vaccine, the risk, I think, from the vaccine of doing harm is probably going to be greater than the risk from the possibility of catching this disease.
Well, that wouldn't be the first time, because we heard Dr. Stanley Laham last week saying that he doesn't believe that the benefit from having the flu vaccine, the flu jab every year, is worth it, that it's actually more dangerous to have. So, I mean, it doesn't seem incredible to me that they're pinning all their hopes on this, you know, Moderna vaccine from a company that's never produced anything for the market before, shoving all this public money towards Moderna in order to order whatever it is, millions of doses of the stuff. Anyway, look, finally, we get the real super scientist, the government's chief scientific officer, Chris Whitty, Voldemort and Gollum's love child, and here he is talking about the end of the Halloween lockdown, the beginning of the winter measures that they're taking. So this is a bit longer, where he goes into some real detail about why they're doing what they're doing now with all these new tiers. And I'm hoping to hear from him why it is that, for example, most of the country has gone from a lower tier before the lockdown into a higher tier after the lockdown, which suggests to me that maybe the Halloween lockdown for 4 weeks was a complete waste of time.
Things were beginning to lighten in some of the areas all around the country, but there remain some areas, quite a number of areas, with really very high rates indeed, many of them coming down, not absolutely all of them. And if we can go on to the next slide, the final slide, please. What you then have is a process of looking at all the data, and these are the things which the Prime Minister was talking about in his speech, looking at the rates of people in all ages. Then we take a look at the second look at the rates in people over 60, because those are the group who are most likely to translate into people who go into hospital, into the NHS, and who die. We also have to look at the rate at which things are changing. So, for example, in many areas of the north of England now, the rates are very high but are beginning to fall, or are falling consistently. But there are some areas, for example, in parts of Kent, where the rates are still going up. We look at the positivity rate, what proportion of people tested are positive, because that is important in case we're not testing enough. And then, importantly, we also look at what the pressure is on the NHS in each of the different areas. So how much problems are there in hospitals? What proportion of the beds are taken up? Are people having to cancel routine operations, or even considering having to cancel more urgent care? So these are the things that we're taking into account technically, and getting advice from local public health experts from around the country. And then that is what goes into making the decisions on the tiers, which ministers make the final decisions on. And just to reiterate the point that Patrick made at the beginning, tier one, which is very similar to the previous tier one, slowed things down but did not stop the rise anywhere. So the reason why tier one at this time of year, with the current measures we've currently got, before we have any vaccines, is relatively limited, is almost certainly anywhere that goes into tier one will rise. And the only places that are there are places with very low rates at the moment. Tier two looks as if it is strong enough to hold the line, so stop things rising, but not reliably to pull things down. And tier three,
we think, based on previous experience, is strong enough to pull things down from a higher peak. So the two situations in particular, three situations we would use this, is if there's a lot of the virus around, it needs to come down. If the NHS locally is under a lot of pressure, or if the rates are beginning to rise, despite everything that's there. And these are the things that feed into the decisions the ministers finally take.
So, Martin, does that make sense to you?
Not really. Of course, what they actually said some months ago, we only discovered it after the event, was that we should go back to lockdown before October the 31st, and the government ignored it. And then, of course, that's Starmer jumped on that, because it was clear that they'd been ignoring the advice to go back to lockdown, and he said you should go back to lockdown, and Boris obviously poo-pooed it. And then, of course, he went back to lockdown because that's what the scientific advice had been. Now, leaving aside, I'm just talking about the politics of this here, that doesn't look very good for Boris. Boris basically at one stage overruled the scientists, saying we're not having another lockdown because it's going to affect my popularity ratings, etc. Starmer found out about it, brings it up at Prime Minister's questions, Boris poo-poos it, and then a week later he's got to do what the scientists told him to do in the first place. We're playing catch-up all the time on this, and if you actually look at the figures from Southeast Asia, I've been looking at them this week. I don't send you them, Tony, because I know you probably won't read them, but the difference in response in Southeast Asian countries and Western countries is enormous.
So is this the...
There are hundreds of times more people dead in Western countries than there are in Southeast Asian countries, because, as was pointed out earlier, because of SARS...
Because we haven't used chloroquine?
No, but it could be things like that. That's another question. The other thing, there are things you can do about an epidemic. Let's imagine that it isn't as dangerous as people feared. Inevitably, at some point, there is going to be a dangerous pandemic. And, of course, in China, they've prepared for a biological warfare attack from the US for years. In the Korean War, North Korea was bombarded with anthrax, botulism, all sorts of things.
But this is Martin, this is not anthrax. It's not botulism.
No,
it's not the plague.
We've got
less than half of 1% mortality rate. And also, the other thing is the figures are being massaged upwards massively by people having COVID added on to their death certificates because they've had a positive test. When 6 months ago they had COVID, they've beaten it, and there's little bits of mashed up COVID in their bloodstream. And this PCR test, all it does is it indicates whether at some point you've had this, and it could even have been, there could be even bits of this COVID around from 2005. If you had SARS, for example, in 2005, the PCR test might pick it up. So it definitely does not indicate whether you're actually contagious or not. That's
I'm not going to argue about that. I will just point out that they have been preparing in these countries for a biological warfare attack for years. Now, it may be that this is actually much less dangerous as a biological warfare agent than it could be, but you still have to follow the same
measures. But isn't it an economic warfare attack?
It is an economic warfare attack, and that's why it probably was placed in Wuhan just before the Chinese New Year, which is at the centre of Chinese
transport
network.
The more you exaggerate the tests, the better the economic warfare attack works. Anyway, let's have hear from Robert now. What you make of what you just heard from Chris Whitty?
I think that the key part was we're in this situation until we get a vaccine. Again, he's a vaccine salesman. Back to basics. The average age of death of people diagnosed with COVID, not even having died specifically from COVID, is, I think, no different than the average age of the average death in the UK, and that's what Philip Davies put in his speech in Parliament as well. And back to the point, 99.3% of people will survive it. The test is not reliable. This is just nonsense. This is pure nonsense. I think this is a fraud. I think an absolute fraud, because this is... this is dishonesty and an abusive position.
Okay, well, look, there's a lot of people that think similarly, and there have been all sorts of protests against it and that sort of thing. We've got another one apparently going on tomorrow. I think it's at King's Cross not far from central London, organised by the various groups. I say organised, but there's... I'm just trying to run through them. You've got Stop New Normal, which is Piers Corbyn and his mob. I'm sure they're a very affable crowd. Stand Up X, you've also got Event 202. And finally, what's the last one? Save Our Rights. So there's at least four of these sort of various groups involved in these. Do you think that the protests make any difference? So you might say, actually, someone from Hong Kong, Robert, that no, they don't, because they didn't really make much of a difference in Hong Kong, even though you have millions of people out on the streets, so, you know, vast proportion, you know, nearly half the population last year.
I think that the good side of protests are it gets people together of who feel the same way, and it makes them feel good, and it makes them feel like they're doing something. So it gives them a certain amount of energy in the short term. But protesting actually over the long term is exhausting. It's really, really very, very tiring. And in Hong Kong, you know, as you said, you had 1 million on the street, 2 million on the street, followed by about 6 months of hundreds of thousands each weekend on the street. And this is out of a population of just over 7 million. But after that, the government got all the legislation that it wanted, did exactly what it wanted. No impact on that. And even if we take mainland China, when you had Tiananmen Square protests, you know, the tanks rolled over people, it was captured on television. So what? After that date, China still grew. Australia, as Martin pointed out, Australia, New Zealand have all signed trade deals with China. So, you know, all the protests have just been crushed, and all the governments have just got what they wanted. And in the UK, I think this government, you've heard it from Boris, you've heard it from Whitty, they've all said that, hey, we're where we are until we get the vaccine. And we've had the mood of Parliament, according to Philip Davies, is that the vaccine may not be mandatory, but there are going to be restrictions on you. So the protest needs to perhaps rethink a better strategy. And maybe on this march, people could talk to each other and say, how do we actually gain physical control of the things we want to go and do? For example, if you go to shops, you've got some thugs or some bodyguards or bouncers, whatever you want to call them, on the door. They have physical control of the entrance. And people might say, oh, let's try non-voluntary compliance. So if we don't like this shop, we'll go to somewhere else. But the problem is, if all the shops do it and say you've got to have a vaccine, you're in stuck. Because as Philip Davies in his other email wrote to me and said, look, Parliament doesn't want to get involved in this. It's a private contract between you and the different companies. The problem is, if all the companies have the same policy, what do you go and do? So I think it's important for people to kind of go beyond protest, or maybe target the protest at a few people who are very troublesome, and maybe try to convince workers, perhaps at British Airways, that, you know, if they're going to want to continue working at British Airways on a flight, they're going to have a vaccine.
Yeah, because it does seem to me as if people are being, industries are being picked off one by one. So once one caves in, then they know that another will cave in. But I mean, one key thing here is that we're dealing with a kind of grey area between what is law and what is just simply guidelines.
Well, I can answer that one straight away. I think in Birmingham today, two police officers charged a woman with not wearing a mask, and she said, look, I don't have to wear a mask because I've got medical exemptions. I don't have to tell you what they are. And anyway, these are just guidelines. Guidelines and law are not the same thing, and there's plenty of case law on that, all the way to the House of Lords in England and also to the Court of Final Appeal in Hong Kong. I'm not sure if anyone's gone to the new Supreme Court in England, but certainly recently in Hong Kong, guidelines and law are not the same thing. So even if you comply with guidelines, you could still be breaking the law. So the two are separate. Guidelines are a grey area. They provide guidance. That's all they do. But they do not, and they are not, the law. And that's really important to recognise that. I think in this case, what the police are doing is they're saying, who's got the burden of proof as to whether you have a medical exemption or not? So we're going to try it on. What we're going to do is we're going to issue with a summons. You're going to have to take it to the magistrate, and the magistrate's going to have to decide if you have to prove to the magistrate that you have a medical exemption or not. Factor in another act, the Disability Discrimination Act, where you don't have to tell you what the disability is. That is law. These are regulations. I think the police got that completely wrong.
Well, I mean, there may be a very method to their madness in that they're trying to really change the onus from, the state onto the person to prove that they've got an exemption, where actually the law says the opposite way around. So they're, they don't necessarily, the police themselves don't necessarily suffer any consequences for trying it on in this way. But anyway, look, well, just cut to the chase. How do you think we can win this, Robert? I mean, you must have surely learnt a few lessons from Hong Kong about how to do things. So how do we make sure in the UK that we don't have to suffer with these kind of restrictions almost indefinitely? It seems like a kind of war on the virus is going on forever and ever, a bit like the old war on terror that Bush and Blair started.
And that was based on a lie as well, wasn't it? There were no weapons of mass destruction, and I don't think there's a killer virus here at all. And I think this is simply about forced vaccination, monitoring people and controlling people. That's what the real figures suggest in terms of real deaths.
Yeah, so how do we win? How do we win? So, what's your thoughts?
How do we win? I think, firstly, practically, we need to... first, we do little things that we can control ourselves. Use cash, try to get proper paper bank statements, and don't wear the mask if you don't want to. The less you comply, the better. But ultimately, you've got to target some people, and you've got to make life extremely uncomfortable for the people that want to force this upon you. And you've got to make it so uncomfortable for them that they won't force it upon you. That is what needs to happen.
One of the things I noticed was that the people from the Wellcome Foundation seem to be all over these various government committees. I mean, there are research, they were doing kind of vaccine research and animal research into animal vaccines, that sort of thing, for many, many years. So, you know, maybe just looking, tracking down the people who stand to gain, maybe the directors of Moderna, people like that.
Or, I mean, you could really make it, have protests outside some of the MPs that are calling for vaccinations. Or I think as well, there's one question I would like to know the answer to, if you have any medics, perhaps Dr. Vernon Coleman or a real medical doctor, would be, if people have these vaccines, does that make them contagious? Would they actually spread the disease to other people? Is there a risk of that actually happening?
Well, certainly the trials of the polio vaccine that Bill Gates put together in Africa led to far more deaths. And in fact, they'd almost eradicated polio until Gates came along. And now the vaccine version of the polio is killing more people than were dying of polio before Bill Gates and his vaccine arrived. So certainly that is definitely a possibility. But I'm not a doctor, so I can't answer that one. Anyway, I thought, look, we need to wind up at some point, round off our look at COVID for this week. And I thought quite a nice way to do that would be to have a listen to Peter Hitchens, who's on Talk Radio, which you need a DAB Plus radio for, every Monday, or pretty much most Mondays, after I gather that he does his column in the Mail on Sunday. And here, he's getting sort of increasingly agitated at what he believes is an enormous amount of garbage that's coming out of most of the government organs, which is being also printed and broadcast uncritically by most of the media.
Nothing fundamental is changing. We're in this, I think, until March and probably April, because the government continues to believe and has believed from the start that it is right and cannot understand that it is wrong, which again is another reason for the extraordinary outburst on Twitter on Saturday. But the whole attitude, the whole mad surgeon attitude, you've got a verruca, so I've got to cut off your leg,
right,
continues. And there's a wasp nest in your roof, so I have to burn down your house. Right. They continue to do it. They continue to say, well, I've burnt down your house, so the wasp nest is gone. I've cut off your leg, the verruca's gone. It's a success. And the only thing that we did wrong was we didn't cut your leg off soon enough. We didn't burn your house down soon enough. And people still swallow this garbage. And as long as they continue to swallow this line, even people who are gradually coming round to understanding they've been conned and been deprived of a huge part of their lives and of their future health and wealth, even people like that still at the end of it say, yes, but we should have locked down earlier. The ideology, the dogma of this, the idea that the government knows what it's doing and has a sensible plan still It's still got into people's heads. And until that gets out, the government can continue to mess us around like this. People like you and I can object to it, can tell the truth about it. People like Ross Clark can write about it. The Daily Mail can publish it. But as long as a substantial majority of people still swallow this garbage, we're still stuck with it at least until the spring. And then what happens if another virus emerges?
A bit of a nightmare scenario, Martin. Another virus as well.
That's what I was saying earlier about this is actually a possibly a dry run for another virus, which is actually more deadly than this one, which is why, of course, it's been taken seriously by the Chinese Communist Party, Vietnamese Communist Party, Cuban Communist Party, New Zealand Labour Party. And, of course, they haven't got lockdowns in those countries. They're testing people who show positive symptoms and they're isolating them. That's what they did from the get-go. And, of course, in the developing world, there's a competition going on between who's going to lead in the 21st century.
Is this going to go on forever now, then?
I think in
the whole of humanity.
No. In China,
they're testing and they're isolating still. But
the question for everybody will be, and in some countries, they've basically squashed the virus without using vaccines, by using administrative measures. They've clearly done that. Whether you like the measures or not, they've worked. And you've got China and New Zealand have both done it. New Zealand is one of the oldest democracies in the world. They were the first to give women the vote in the 1880s. They were the first to build a welfare state in the 1930s. And they've also done this now. China, of course, could easily have been a disaster zone with this, but it wasn't, because they jumped all over it. And they've succeeded in jumping all over it. And it's not just them. The Vietnamese, who don't like the Chinese, have done exactly the same.
Martin, you did say all this before. Anyway, let's hear what Robert's got to say on this.
I can't agree that the Chinese have jumped all over it. I go back to Shanghai Airport, where on an internal flight, two people tested positive. The disease must have been alive in China. Secondly, Hong Kong recently opened a travel bubble between Hong Kong and China. Hong Kong have got our daily infection rate down to zero. And since opening up the bubble, we're now about 90 positive tests a day, which would suggest very strongly that people travelling between Hong Kong and China are bringing in the virus.
Well, it sounds like that Hong Kong has done the job, but China hasn't.
No, exactly. I mean, you cannot trust a single word that comes out of China.
Well, we can't trust a single word that comes out of the mouth of Boris Johnson, Chris Whitty, or Patrick Vallance, or the BBC, actually. I thought I'd take a look at some of the great pile of big lies the government and the mass media have been telling the public and politicians about COVID-19. Just take stock of this avalanche of lies. Sometimes you think, well, you know, I can't because there's too many. Anyway, I had a go this week. They tell us the pandemic is still going on when it finished in June. They tell us it was a pandemic when the death rate never hit the criteria for a pandemic. The Lancet published a fraudulent chloroquine article stopping one of the most important cures being used at all. Doom-laden projections, which turned out to be wildly exaggerated, were produced by Bill Gates-funded Imperial College and Johns Hopkins University. Bill Gates has got no medical qualifications and even failed to get a degree, but he'd make a lot of money out of a vaccine. Companies like Microsoft, which Bill Gates owns, although he left, I believe, just as all this was starting, Amazon and Facebook have doubled their value during the COVID lockdowns as people are forced to spend money online. Public Health England is run by Mike Brodie, who's an accountant who also owns Porton Biopharma, which is a private firm based in the UK's biological warfare labs, which shouldn't exist because of international treaties, but do, near Salisbury. Chloroquine, I spoke about a minute ago from about the Lancet, is a known cure for SARS, but the government and health regulators stopped it being used to treat SARS-CoV-2 patients, possibly killing hundreds of thousands of Europeans and Americans. You get natural immunity after recovering from COVID, and they said many don't, but you do. That's just been proven this week. It's almost, in fact, last week, it's almost impossible for asymptomatic people, even the tiny number who have live COVID virus in them, to spread the disease. They said it was possible. Not a single UK child or teenager has died of COVID who didn't have some underlying health conditions. Press stories trying to make out that they had, for example, through Kawasaki syndrome, were fabricated, but they were never afterwards corrected. Pfizer and Moderna vaccines can give you autoimmune disease for life. They say they're safe, but they are genetically engineering human cells, something they've never done before, without actually telling us that's what they're doing. Policies which have led to tens of thousands of unnecessary deaths have been set by civil servants and advisers with vested interest in the pharmaceutical industry, such as George Pascoe Watson, Chris Whitty and Patrick Vallance. The government have consistently resisted attempts to discover the so-called science they base the strict measures on. They will not publish it unless they're absolutely forced to in court. The financing of inadequate compensation for destroying lives and livelihoods and of all government departments is now being run by former Bilderberg, Goldman Sachs, pro-Brussels bank Goldman Sachs guy parachuted into the job. That's Rishi Sunak, and we'll be hearing him from him in a minute. The government is using artificial intelligence to try and manage adverse reactions to the coming vaccine that they say is safe. If it's safe, why do they need to manage these adverse reactions, especially using artificial intelligence so no human beings are actually involved in making these decisions? Public demonstrations, which are physically distanced, with people 2 metres apart, are being shut down by a politicised police charging into crowds and ensuring people would spread infection if it was around. They also say that vaccine hesitancy is a problem and label people anti-vaxxers, where much of it is actually built on rational science. Also, Del Bigtree's 2017 documentary Vaxxed was censored from television and just about every cinema in the world, despite being applauded at the Cannes Film Festival. And opposition doctors' voices, including via this show, have been banned, silenced by the government's behaviour insights team, mass media, Ofcom and station managers. The bullying of the mentally ill, disabled, frail and elderly by exaggerating the COVID threat is unprecedented in modern history. Also, the government, the media and Big Pharma spent a decade trying to discredit Dr. Andrew Wakefield, even throwing him out of the British Medical Association because he was warning us unsafe vaccines were coming to the market, something that surely should have been taken more seriously. The UK Labour Party opposition have been arguing for greater, longer lockdowns rather than opposing the government. And almost all the commentators and politicians who support the lockdowns and destruction of the economy also supported Remain in the Brexit campaign. So that's my little summary for this week. And we'll hear now from Neil Oliver. He's someone who's a presenter of history programmes. I don't think he's a medical doctor, but he has some interesting things to say about the hate crime bill and the shutting down of debate, basically the censorship going on in Scotland.
Everything's coming down to the coarsest, you know, most tragically predictable terms. You know, it's all about, you know, if people don't agree with the orthodoxy and if they don't loudly support the orthodoxy, whatever it is, then they're stupid, they're idiots, they're racists, they're misogynists, they're Islamophobes, they're transphobes. And this way in which hate is just becoming part of the daily stock and trade about how you keep people in line. You know, people are in agreement. People are now just frightened to see, to ask questions, because they're so simply the focus of hatred or being dismissed as idiots or stupid people. And all you're doing to people, millions of people are just learning to break the law every day and keep their heads down. Millions of people are just learning to keep their opinions to themselves. Mm. You know, in the context of that hate crime bill that's floating about, you know, this idea that it would be that if you were having a conversation, if someone was having a conversation around the dinner table in their home, and it involved someone saying something that could be interpreted by someone as hate speech, that you would be prosecuted for that, for something that had happened in your own home. Mm. Now, implicit in that is that somehow or other, the authorities are going to get to hear about a private conversation. Now, how is that done? It can only be done either by an informant who's part of that conversation then going to the authorities, or it's by some sort of application of technology.
Yeah.
So private conversations within the home are being listened to and reported to the authorities. Now, that's the application of fear. Mm. That's a government that rather than address people's concerns, it just goes after making sure it's not possible to dissent, not possible to question the orthodoxy. And that's done by making people even afraid to speak in their own homes.
Yes.
So that's Neil Oliver, the TV presenter, destroying his BBC career by appearing on talk radio, as he does, I think, is every Tuesday morning. Robert, it sounds to me, from what he's saying there, that you've got something similar in the UK going on to what's been happening in China over free speech, doesn't it? I mean, you know, the idea that these are certain things you just can't talk about.
Yeah, I mean, again, I go back to the thing. This is that there is a global force or global group of people running the whole world and dictating what happens, when it happens, who can do what, who can say what, who's got to be vaccinated, who's got to be monitored. It's the same thing. And what this hate speech bill reminds me of is it takes me back to what the Keir Starmer's version of human rights, you know, to him that would be about human rights, whereas to what I would call rational people, who he would probably call anti-human rights, this is absolutely totally against human rights. It's stopping people speaking, it's stopping people expressing thought, and it's just giving more power to a central authority. And if you want to get on, progress, get your social credit points, then don't say anything, even in private. It's absolute control. I don't like this. I don't like the way this is going at all.
Martin?
Well, we all agree that there are some limits to freedom of speech in practice. But the question is where those limits are going to be drawn. And it's quite legitimate for Neil Oliver there to say that this is being drawn in the wrong place in the wrong way. I have my doubts about whether people can, in fact, be prosecuted for private racist conversations. I still hear plenty of them when I'm walking around. I don't intervene and nobody else does. But at the same time, there are also, laws against incitement and so on. And I think they're perfectly adequate as they are. I can't see that you need to tighten them up.
This is really, in writ large, within the Labour Party, hasn't it? Because even basic criticism and statement of facts has been leading to MPs like Ken Livingstone being removed from the party, Martin.
Yeah, I mean, the body which has produced this report on anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, there's a lot of questions to be asked about that, because it was originally set up by a Labour government, and it wasn't very liked by the minority communities when they set it up. And it's subsequently had its funding massively reduced by the Tory government. And so, for example, they haven't responded to the Muslim Council of Britain's hundreds of examples of Tory Islamophobia on social media. They've decided that that's not worthy of their attention. But they have brought out this report about so-called anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. In actual fact, if you read the report, it definitely says that there is no institutional anti-Semitism in the Labour Party.
Well, the obvious thing to say here is this is the thought police. So there are certain things you are allowed to think, and there's other things you're not.
Yeah, and in reality, in the real world, people think what they want to think anyway, and attempts to control people's thoughts don't actually always work.
Well, you can think it, but you're not allowed to say it, even in private.
Well, you're going to, as I say, in any society, there are limits to what you can. I mean, we're not under Ofcom rules now, because we're on, this is a podcast. But if we were under Ofcom rules at BCFM, I wouldn't be able to say the word. But I can.
Well, you can't, because actually, Martin, because we have to edit that out anyway.
Well, yeah, but it's a live show, Tony. Yes. I'm just making the point
It's a very cheap way to make that point.
All right, but I'm just making the point. Everybody accepts that
children,
there's a limit.
Children may be listening. Elderly people might be listening. They don't want to necessarily hear that.
I work in schools and we don't swear at the children for that. And you'd lose your job if you did.
Try and behave yourself here as you would in school.
All right, well, I'm just pointing out that I'm actually in favour of freedom of speech. But often, if you start accusing people, for example, you know, we could start talking about 9/11, which it's not weapons of mass destruction. The 9/11 attack was carried out from inside the US security forces, as we well know, and there's massive evidence to show it. But you're not allowed to go on the mainstream media and say it.
And the Israeli, because you seem to be avoiding talking about the Israelis.
The Israelis were involved in it, absolutely. Israelis were definitely Mossad agents.
That is a key point, when it comes to what's happening in the Labour Party, too, is that the criticism of Israel within the Labour Party has been virtually shut down.
Absolutely.
Destroyed.
I mean, so
it's opening up a potential route for a war to happen here without any criticism coming from the main opposition in the UK.
Yeah, well, what's going to happen is there's a massive row developing within the Labour Party about all of this.
Yeah, and of course, anyone that speaks up is just expelled.
Yes. Yeah, so in that case, you have to form another party or whatever, don't you? And, of course, under the first-past-the-post system, which we labour under in this country, that means it's a disaster and the Tories are going to be in power forever because the system's rigged to keep them in power. That's why the IRA went to war with them in 1969, because the system's rigged.
Anyway,
and what you were talking earlier, Robert, about targeting people who are the real enemies. Two Tory prime ministers were nearly killed by the IRA. Both of them were lucky on the day to survive. And that, in fact, is part of our history as a country, and you can't make it go away.
Anyway, Robert, what do you make of what you've heard from particularly on this whole idea of free speech? And have you got any final words before we say goodbye? Because we're going to have some music in a minute, and then we'll be talking about non-COVID. COVID will probably creep in, and because we're going to have a look at some of the different protest movements, including things like Extinction Rebellion and Black Lives Matter. So I guess COVID is bound to creep in. And your final comments, please.
On freedom of speech, I take the view that free speech means free speech. You can say whatever you want without the limits, so long as it's true. So I think you can express any view about anything. The only thing where any limit should be would be if it's something that's just blatantly not true, and therefore causes a loss or harm as a result of that. So for example, you know, you say Perrier water's got poison in it or something, it's not a true statement, it's going to cause harm. But if you express opinions about anything, I think that should be free. And
I mean, you could say, for example, that chloroquine is a very dangerous drug which gives you heart attacks.
If that's a true statement, I don't know about.
But it isn't, is it?
But,
and that's what they've been saying. In fact, that's what that was been. We under Ofcom were mandated to say. Effectively, we've got to put out government medical policy as the policy, and we're not allowed to criticise it. The other thing that they were saying was that it was safe to move people from hospitals into care homes back in March, which of course it wasn't, and possibly tens of thousands of people died as a result. So there seems to be a very much politicisation of free speech. But anyway, look, from all the way from Hong Kong, very late at night there, Robert Hanson, thanks ever so much for joining us. Hope to have you on again sometime, you know, well past your bedtime. But thank you very much for spending at last hour and a half with us. Now some music, and we'll be going to take our weekly look around the world in the non-COVID world after this. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Now, Martin, maybe we could start and have a look. Sort of picking, we're going to do some of the more newsy news stories in a minute, but just picking up on these various movements that are going around the world, particularly the three main ones. One is the anti-lockdown movement, which we've been talking about that just now, but also Black Lives Matter and Extinction Rebellion.
Yeah, well, I mean, they're obviously this is a time of great social unrest, some of which is being manipulated, as we know.
How do we identify a movement which is being manipulated and one which is a genuine grassroots
well,
movement?
Well, it's usually the case that both things are going on simultaneously. So, for example, I'm perfectly sure that plenty of people in Belarus are unhappy about Lukashenko and would like to see him out. But they're also working in cahoots with Western intelligence services. And that doesn't discredit them completely, but they've got to recognise that they're not entirely a spontaneous movement. And that's just an example. So, you know, Black Lives Matter has been heavily colonised by corporate interests. But that doesn't mean that everybody in Black Lives Matter is a tool of the corporations. It's actually quite tricky. And we know, for example, because of the investigations that are going on into the special demonstration squad, that we've been infiltrated by all sorts of spooks for years and years and years. And no doubt those people were the ones that were suggesting to do silly things and all the rest of it. So, you know, manipulation, I'm afraid, just goes with the territory.
Okay, well, we're going to be picking up on this in a minute with a deep look at the two of those groups. One is called Event 202, with Simon Marshall as one of the founders of that, which is an anti-lockdown group. And I think over the next few weeks, we'll try and have a really good close look at all of those groups. And also, we'll be looking at Extinction Rebellion with a chap we had on last week, Heiko Kuh, who does the Speaker's Corner programme on Resonance FM in London. He did a hilarious, I mean, maybe you might even want to comment on this now, Martin, actually. Speaker's Corner is some place that you've been at quite a lot, and he goes there every Sunday. And recently the police have been stopping people speaking at Speaker's Corner.
Yeah, well, does he broadcast from Speaker's Corner, this Resonance
FM? He does is he does a programme during the week where he records a lot of it at Speaker's Corner.
Right.
And he's finding that the police was trying to stop him speaking. So, but you are allowed to go through Hyde Park and exercise. So what he decided to do was get himself a bicycle and actually do his speech whilst he was cycling round and round Speaker's Corner. So we'll be hearing a bit of that later. Extinction Rebellion is another one, and we'll be hearing Heiko's critique of who he thinks Extinction Rebellion are.
Can I just comment about Speaker's Corner, since you asked me?
Yeah.
In 1991, in the run-up to the then Gulf War, I was speaking at Speaker's Corner every day against the war. So I was going down there at 10 o'clock in the morning and basically staying till dusk. After a couple of days, I was getting quite a good crowd to listen. The police came over to me and said, "You do realise that you're only allowed to speak at Speaker's Corner on Sunday afternoons, after midday, and that the bylaws say you're only to address religious topics." And I said, "Really?" I said, "Yes, that's the laws of the bylaws of the park." And I turned round to the audience I had, you know, maybe 100 people, and said, "Well, you'd better arrest me then." And they just glared and withdrew. So in actual fact, talking about freedom of speech being, guaranteed, that is, in fact, the rules of Speaker's Corner, so that they've already got the bylaws to clear people off the park speaking out of turn already if they want to use them. And everybody thinks that, of course, that you're allowed to go there and say what you like. In actual fact, there's already a law that stops you from doing that.
Well, there is also a law, a natural law, which means that if there are a lot of people listening to you, Martin, like 100 people, and you've got two police officers, they're going to have quite a lot of trouble arresting you, aren't they?
I think that's what it boils down to in the end is a trial of strength. And of course, in the past, they've been quite willing to let people speak there. They realise that they can't stop it, especially if there's a lot of people there. But of course, with the new regulations about meeting in large groups, this is why they're taking a different line. Because obviously, if people get the idea that they can meet in large groups and it will be tolerated, then they'll lose control of the situation.
Okay, well, let's get cracking into the international news this week. And Israel is suspected today of killing a top Iranian scientist. It wouldn't be the first one, Martin, would it?
No.
This is literally, you know, we've had the Americans, Trump and his chums, assassinating, executing Soleimani while he was over in Iraq at the beginning of the year, almost to sort of set the year off, set the decade off. With a horrific assassination. A top Iranian scientist was assassinated near Tehran in an ambush on Friday. Iranian state media, that's today, first reported. Israel has previously alleged the scientist Mohsen Farikhadez, that's a terrible pronunciation, but headed an Iranian military nuclear program. In a statement, Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif condemned the attack and said there are serious indications of an Israeli role in the assassination. In 2018, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called out Farikhadzadeh at a news conference and said, "Remember that name."
Well, they're not just doing that. I mean, they bombed in Syria yesterday and killed 20-odd Shia militia people who are fighting for the Syrian government, actually from Pakistan. And what they're doing now is Trump is running down the clock. They are basically trying to provoke the Iranians, and the Iranians have made a statement to all of their supporters all over the Middle East that they are not to retaliate to any attacks that the Americans launch on them.
Well, Middle East,
because they don't want
Martin,
to have a war.
Martin, Middle East Eye today is saying that Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu tried to convince Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to agree to an attack on an Iranian nuclear facility during a secret meeting last weekend.
It was a secret meeting which both sides admitted that they'd been to. And of course,
they boast about these things.
Well, they do. This is the way the Israelis operate, you know. We can't tell you anything about what we're doing, but in actual fact, we've assassinated all these people because we're so good at spying and that we can get away with it. There's even a book called Rise Up and Kill, which you can buy in the bookshop.
Rise Up and Kill First by Ronan Bergman.
Yes, and it's basically boasting about all the illegal actions that they've carried out over the years. But at the same time, of course, on the other side of their mouth, they're squeaky clean Democrats and they never do anything wrong. Extraordinary.
The other thing, of course, is that the Israelis are known to have something like 200 nuclear weapons of their own, aren't they? I mean,
yeah,
this is Colin Powell's figures.
Yeah, well, so you could
they don't really talk about
you
that.
You could argue that the Iranians would be perfectly within their rights to retaliate by assassinating a top Israeli nuclear scientist, wouldn't you? But that would be an act of war.
Well, I mean, the key thing here, though, is they're saying he's a military nuclear scientist, whereas the Iranians would say, and many others would say, I'm not sure whether you would say, that there is no military nuclear program in Iran.
There isn't really. I mean, they've developed a program. I mean, they've got. If you're going to develop nuclear weapons, you need to enrich uranium or plutonium to something like 90%, and they've never gone anywhere near that. So they just want nuclear power, and they're entitled to have it under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which they've signed, and the Israelis haven't.
Surely they've got a nuclear military program. It's just secret.
No. I don't think they have.
So didn't they buy any black market nuclear weapons from the Soviet Union?
Martin, let me finish.
Didn't they buy any black market nuclear weapons, like SS-20s, for example, from places like Ukraine as the Soviet Union was collapsing in the 1990s? If they're available on the black market, the Iranians would be stupid not to snap them up, wouldn't they?
Well, there's a fatwa by Ayatollah Khomeini saying that we're not going to get nuclear weapons because they're un-Islamic. What they've got is chemical and biological weapons, which can actually devastate Israel. And Hezbollah have got thousands now of very accurate missiles, and the accuracy of the Iranian missiles was demonstrated when they whacked the US bases after the assassination of Soleimani. And I think probably what happened in that meeting between Netanyahu and MBS was that MBS talked Netanyahu down because the Saudis are in the firing line. If there is a war with Iran, the Saudi oil industry is going to be incinerated within the first half an hour, and possibly thousands of US military personnel are going to be killed straight away. And therefore, you know, the Iranians are biding their time, literally waiting for Biden. And of course they're being provoked pretty badly. But then the line they've given out very clearly is nobody is to retaliate until Trump has gone.
So why are they saying that?
Because they don't want a war, unlike the fools in Israel who think they do.
Tensions are simmering. There's lots of Israeli news, actually. Tensions are simmering over possible US strikes on Iran. At the same time, Israel is demanding from the UN Security Council that they act over the Iranian presence in Syria, which is a bit bizarre, really, because I thought President Assad was the ruler, democratically elected ruler of Syria, and he invited the Iranians in, as I understood it. So why would the Israelis demand action over that?
Well, I mean, it's obvious why. I mean, they dispute that Assad was democratically elected, although, as you say, there was an election in 2014, which he won quite handsomely. Not that it was reported in the West. And there were pictures of thousands and thousands of people queuing up outside the Syrian embassy in Beirut to vote in the election, all carrying pictures of Assad and waving Syrian flags. Well, basically, they don't want... Ultimately, the Israelis are in occupation of other people's land. The Golan Heights, for example, is part of Syria, recognised as part of Syria by everybody other than the Americans. And ultimately, the Syrian position is, we're taking that back. You took it off us in 1967, but it don't belong to you.
Okay.
And it's got oil in it, which we need.
Also, a US general today is saying that China and Russia is a growing threat in space. So this is a new space force that Trump has announced. They're obviously realising that they're not alone up there, that the Chinese and the Russians are up there too.
Yes, and of course Boris Johnson announced that we too have a space force. We don't want to be left out, do we? The thing about war in space that strikes me is that there's lots of satellites up there. You know, the Telstar satellite that went up, you know, in the 60s, and loads of others are now up there. But they're incredibly vulnerable, as you can imagine. A piece of electronic kit flying around above the Earth's surface is a sitting target. It doesn't take much to knock it down. And that's one of the problems that the US has got with their massive reliance upon this kinds of technology. I mean, what the Chinese will do at the beginning of a fight in the South China Sea is shoot down all the US satellites so that they're blind, and then sink their aircraft carriers with their missiles. That's what will happen.
Okay, well, obviously the big news really is what's happening with the transition in the United States between Trump and Biden. So I thought we'd start by having a listen to President Trump. I don't know, he seems to have got some sort of not such a good microphone as he had when before the election. I was going to say when he was president, but it always seems like Biden is now in charge. His microphone, I'm afraid, isn't such good quality. But we'll have a listen now to what Trump is saying this week to the Pennsylvania State Senate hearings on voter fraud. Because it does seem, maybe before we hear from Trump, Martin, what you make of this. Because the Trump camp are saying that we are going through the courts, and by the time it comes to the middle of January, it may well have reached the Supreme Court, and we may actually have got some of these results overturned.
Yeah, and what they're hoping is that they can create enough doubt about it that the Republican legislatures in various states will overrule the election and appoint their own electors to the Electoral College, which will then give Trump the presidency. So they have got a strategy here. It involves basically saying that proving to the satisfaction of the legislature in each of these countries, because when you get to something like this in the US, people are now looking at the rule book, yeah, just as we're looking at the rule book in the Labour Party, yeah. Because when you get to these things, suddenly the rule book matters.
Well,
who's
if you're
got
talking
the right
about
to do
trying to persuade
on what
people
basis?
And bamboozle them, surely that's exactly what's been happening with the Western press. All we're hearing in the press is there's no evidence here. Actually, there are several. Actually, what looked like quite important.
Yeah. Well, if you want me to comment on that, then I will. I've been looking at all of this. Some of it, frankly, is. It's frivolous because even if they proved that there were a few hundred votes wrong here or there, it's not. I mean, Biden is 7 million votes ahead. You know, it's a lot.
Anyway,
and if you're going to overturn that, you've got to show there's more happen than just a few ballots out of place.
Maybe the last thing we hear from Donald Trump. But anyway, let's have a listen to what he had to say at these Pennsylvania State Senate hearings.
What happened here? This is not the United States of America. What happened? And I think everybody knows that. That's why you're. There, and that's why you're so vehement about it. We have many, many cases, many, many cases of people walking in. A woman, an elderly woman, walks in looking forward to voting November 3rd and says, oh, good, where would I go about voting? I'm sorry, you've already voted. Your ballot is in. I said, no, I didn't vote. I didn't vote. No, your ballot is in. You've already voted. In all cases for Biden, by the way. She said, no, no, I want to vote. Nope, your ballot is in. And then they give her a provisional ballot to sign, which goes nowhere. It's a disgrace that this is happening to our country. We won this election by a lot. We got 74 million votes. And if you would have said 74 million votes the day before the election, every single professional in the business would have said there's no way of beating that. We got 11 million votes more than we had 4 years before in 2016. And we got many votes more than Ronald Reagan had when he won 49 states. And nobody would have said we even had a chance of losing. And all you had to do is take a look at the numbers at 10 o'clock in the evening when everybody thought the election was virtually over. And then very weird things happened. But they're not weird to professionals, and they're not weird to Dominion and other people that operate machines, and they're not weird to the people that handle the ballots where they were flooding the market. People were getting two and three and four ballots in their home. People that were dead were signing up for ballots. Not only were they coming in and putting in a ballot, but dead people were requesting ballots, and they were dead for years, and they were requesting ballots. And the whole world is watching us. The whole world is watching the United States of America, and we can't let them get away with it. And we have judges that are afraid to make a decision. We have judges that don't want to do the same thing. A very good lawyer said, well, sir, I mean, that's a big statement for a judge to overthrow an election. I said, really? If he got hundreds of thousands of votes more than he was entitled to get through all of the things that I'm listening to right now, and you're just covering a few of them, we have hundreds and hundreds of affidavits of stories that are even worse than the stories I'm hearing. Why wouldn't they overturn an election? Certainly overturn it in your state, because we have other states that are just as bad. If you look at Michigan with Detroit, you look at the things that happened in Detroit, where you have a voter, but you have more votes than you have voters. You take a look at Detroit, Michigan. You have more votes than you have voters. And then you have two people that don't want to certify. They don't want to certify. And they're harassed violently. And they turned off the cameras during the harassment for 2 hours. And then they said, wow. And they were afraid and they voted. And then they went back to sign and they couldn't do it because they said, we can't do it because this is corrupt. This is horrible what's taking place. Think of it. More votes than you have voters. But that was the least of it. They have things that were as bad as that. And this is going on all over. We're doing very well in a lot of states. A lot of good things are happening in Georgia. We're getting little help from government, but a lot of good things are happening in Georgia, Wisconsin, and Michigan. They're seeing what happened in Detroit. And we sure are looking at what's happening in Pennsylvania and Philadelphia. What happened in Philadelphia, they keep the poll watchers not only in pens, but they keep them out of the building. And the only reason they got back into the building was they got a court order. And then the definition of back into the building was very far away where they couldn't see anything. And they talk about closed circuit television, except you couldn't see it because the picture was so unclear. You didn't even know what they were doing. They could have been playing a baseball game. So it's a very sad thing for our country to have this. And they have to turn over the results. It would be easy for me to say, oh, let's worry about 4 years from now. No, this election was lost by the Democrats. They cheated. It was a fraudulent election. They flooded the market. They defrauded everybody on ballots. And I just want to thank everybody for being there.
So that's Donald Trump there sounding, I don't know, he's sounding like a loser, Martin, but is he just a bad loser, or do you think that there has been, you know, an enormous amount of election fraud? Certainly, the thing I would say is that postal ballots and electronic voting do offer enormous opportunities for fraud.
Well, I've been following it fairly closely, and I think the thing about postal voting is by the by. Don't forget that even if Trump were to win, because various of these lawsuits were successful, he probably wouldn't have won the popular vote. The Republicans never win the popular vote, very rarely, in presidential elections. And that's because the American system, a bit like the British system, is rigged. So the Senate, you get two senators for each state. So small states in rural states like Wyoming get two senators, and California, with millions of residents, only gets two senators. So in other words, it's very difficult for the Democrats to win the Senate. In the congressional elections, the Republicans have basically gerrymandered lots of the constituencies. So what they do as soon as they're elected is they redraw the boundary to make sure that they will be re-elected. The Tories here are going to do exactly the same thing, incidentally. So it's very difficult for the Democrats to win on those either congressional or Senate. But it looks like they've won the congressional election, because in the last seven presidential elections, the Democrats won the popular vote five of those times. And in 2016, Trump won the Electoral College with 3 million less votes than Hillary Clinton. So all we're talking about here, even if he manages to prove that he's been cheated, is that he's won the Electoral College. He still won't have won the popular vote. And you say, well, that doesn't matter. That's the American system. It's the Electoral College. But of course, we are not in America. We're in Britain. And we compare, for example, the Russian system and the American system. Both democratic systems, but in the Russian system, the one with the most votes wins. In the American system, quite frequently, the one with the least votes wins. Now, that is, it doesn't matter in one level, but on another level, it does matter, because it's about legitimacy in the eyes of the world. Now, let's come to this electronic voting machine thing, because this is the important bit. The electronic voting machine thing, at first, I was beginning to get interested in this, because it looks as if the CIA may have used electronic voting software to switch the election to Biden. But Sidney Powell, who is was Trump's lawyer, is saying that the election has been stolen by a cabal of China, Iran, and Venezuela. Now, if she'd come out and said, no, the CIA have stolen the election, then my ears would prick up. And I say, right, that's interesting. That could be the case. But if you're going to blame Maduro, who's dead, probably murdered by the US, incidentally, since we're
Chavez.
Chavez, sorry. You know, if we're talking about freedom of speech. And basically, if the right wing in the US have had the election stolen from them by the CIA, then all I can say is ha, ha, ha. I mean, the 9/11 attacks, as Trump said on the day on the 9/11 attacks, these buildings were bombed.
Well, I mean,
they were bombed.
It actually doesn't really matter which side wins.
So no,
long as the coup victors get their person in place, whether it's Kamala Harris or Joe Biden. Anyway, look, we're going to hear from Joe Biden.
I've got no faith in them at all, but there you go.
And it was interesting that, I find it fascinating that Thanksgiving in the United States goes back to 1637 with a massacre of the Indians. The Manataka American Indian Council has done an introduction for teachers, which if you put in Pequot Indian Massacre Thanksgiving on your favourite search engine, not necessarily or preferably not Google, you'll find this Plymouth Thanksgiving story, the real story of Thanksgiving. Most of us associate the holiday with happy pilgrims and Indians sitting down to a big feast, and that did happen once. The story began in 1614 when a band of English explorers sailed home to England with a ship full of Patuxet Indians bound for slavery. They left behind smallpox, which virtually wiped out those who had escaped. By the time the pilgrims arrived in Massachusetts Bay, they found only one living Patuxet Indian, a man named Squanto, who'd survived slavery in England and knew their language. He taught them to grow corn and to fish, negotiated a peace treaty. But anyway, a little bit later, the Pequot Indians, which is it's part of New England, basically down Massachusetts, just to the west of Cape Cod, they were massacred on this day, and now they call it Thanksgiving, Martin.
Yeah, well, it's all the question. I mean, history is a very interesting subject. And when people say, oh, you're rewriting history, what I feel about that is that we rewrite history in every generation. We're still rewriting books about Alfred the Great because we find new things about him, and archaeology, for example, and all sorts of other things. So every generation rewrites history according to its own concerns and interests. So there's nothing bad or wrong with rewriting history. You should rewrite history. So, of course, throughout most of modern history in the US, that Thanksgiving has been treated as some kind of positive celebration of the country.
So
but, of course, the real truth is actually two-sided.
So in 1637, just before the English Civil War broke out over here, in near present-day Groton in Connecticut, over 700 men, women and children of the Pequot tribe had gathered for their annual Green Corn Festival, which is now Thanksgiving. In the pre-dawn hours, the sleeping Indians were surrounded by English and Dutch mercenaries who ordered them to come outside. Those who came out were shot or clubbed to death, while the terrified women and children who huddled inside the longhouse were burnt alive. The next day, the governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony declared a day of Thanksgiving because 700 unarmed men, women and children had been murdered. Cheered by their victory, the brave colonists and their Indian allies attacked village after village. Women and children over 14 were sold into slavery, while the rest were murdered. Boats loaded with as many as 500 slaves regularly left the ports of New England. Bounties were paid for Indian scalps to encourage as many deaths as possible. Following an especially successful raid against the Pequot in what's now Stamford, Connecticut, the churches announced a second day of Thanksgiving to celebrate victory over the heathen savages. During the feasting, the hacked-off heads of natives were kicked through the streets like soccer balls. Even the friendly Wampanoag did not escape the madness. Their chief was beheaded and his head was impaled on a pole in Plymouth, Massachusetts. Well, there apparently, Martin, were so many killings and massacres, and there were so many Thanksgivings that they had to bring them all together under Abraham Lincoln, who decreed this day as Thanksgiving Day, that Pequot massacre was the only one. Otherwise, that there would have been quite a lot of different Thanksgiving days. But anyway, let's have a listen now to Joe Biden and his Thanksgiving speech, just bearing in mind the history of all of this. Just a few minutes, but Joe Biden really talking about what Thanksgiving means today under COVID.
For the Bidens, the days around Thanksgiving have always been a time to remember all we had to be grateful for, and a time to begin to think about Christmas and begin even to do the Christmas list. But this year, because we care so much for each other, we're going to be having a separate Thanksgiving for Jill and I. We'll be at our home in Delaware with our daughter and our son-in-law. The rest of the family will be doing the same thing in small groups. So I know how hard it is to forego family traditions, but it's so very important. Our country is in the middle of a dramatic spike in cases. We're now averaging 160,000 new cases a day. No one will be surprised if we hit 200,000 cases in a single day. Many local health systems are at risk of being overwhelmed. That's the plain and simple truth. Nothing made up. It's real. And I believe you always deserve to hear the truth. Hear the truth from your president. We have to try to slow the growth of this virus. We owe it to the doctors and the nurses and other frontline workers, care workers, who've risked their lives, some lost their lives, put so much on the line in a heroic battle in this virus against it for so long. You know, we owe that to our fellow citizens who need access to hospital beds and care to fight this disease. We owe it to one another. It's literally our patriotic duty as Americans. It means wearing a mask, keeping social distancing, limiting the size of any group we're in. Until we have a vaccine, these are the most effective tools to combat the virus. Starting on day one of my presidency, we will take steps that will change the course of this disease. More testing. We'll find people with cases and get them away from one another, slowing the number of infections. More protective gear for businesses and our schools to do the same, reducing the number of cases. Clear guidance will get more businesses and more schools open. We all have a role to play in beating this crisis. The federal government has vast powers to combat the virus. And I commit to you, I will use all of those powers to lead a national coordinated response. But the federal government can't do this alone. Each of us has a responsibility in our own lives to do what we can do to slow the virus. Every decision we make matters. Every decision we make can save lives. None of these steps we're asking people to take are political statements. Every one of them is based on science, real science. Now, the good news is there has been significant record-breaking progress made recently in developing a vaccine. And several of these vaccines look extraordinarily effective. And it happens that we're on track for the first immunization to begin by late December, early January. Then we'll need to put in place a distribution plan to get the entire country immunized as soon as possible, which we will do. But it's going to take time. I'm hoping the news of the vaccine will serve as an incentive to every American to take these simple steps to get control of the virus. There's real hope, tangible hope. So hang on. Don't let yourself surrender to the fatigue, which I understand it is real fatigue. I know we can and we will beat this virus. America's not going to lose this war. We'll get our lives back. Life is going to return to normal, I promise you. This will happen. This will not last forever.
Well, maybe it will. Martin, interesting, isn't it? This whole idea of, we've had the war on terror. He's making it absolutely clear there's a war on the virus now, and we're going to get control of the virus.
Well, I mean,
is he?
Well, I mean, basically, that's a he's trying to reassure people and shore up his own position.
I mean, I would have thought actually it's largely our immune systems that deals with viruses rather than Joe Biden.
Well, look, I mean, we've had an hour and a half on coronavirus in the beginning of the show. I think it's a biological warfare attack on China. It's not designed to kill loads of people. It was designed to kill the Chinese economy. Chinese intelligence services jumped
all over.
Can
a government control a virus?
Yes, they've done it in China and New Zealand. Governments have done it not by using vaccines either. So I'm not a big fan of vaccines at all. The vaccine stuff is a load of hype, as far as I'm concerned. What you can do is you can. I mean, Ebola has been controlled in Africa, but not by using vaccines.
So Sleepy Joe's right about this one.
I don't know whether he's right about it. They've let it go so far.
Well,
now.
He's saying, "Trust me, it's okay. Yes, I will control the virus for you."
That's what he's going to say as president, isn't he? Not going to say, "Freak out, we've lost control of this," is he?
Was he ever going to get control of it?
Well, we don't know. No. As things stand, they haven't got control of it.
Well, they haven't. They seem to have lots and lots of positive tests. But anyway, yeah, let's not go back there.
Yeah, we're just going round and round in circles.
Interesting to look. Well, you are. It's interesting to look at what Biden is saying, though, and how he's putting all this, because this is actually very different to Donald Trump, isn't it?
Yes. So, in other words, he's trying to underline that he isn't Trump. He's trying to sort of smooth over the transition so that he's basically a safe pair of hands. I've been a vice president. I've been a senator since 1973. Trust me, Uncle Joe, I will make sure that things are all right. And that terrible Trump guy who's, can't keep his finger off the Twitter feed. I'm going to be I'm bringing the changes here. You can see what he's trying to do. He's just trying to calm everything down and make sure that he ends up in charge. And then he's going to make people feel that he's capable of dealing with it. Whether that's true, I doubt, because the US society isn't well organized to deal with anything.
He's doing exactly
like
the same as is happening over here, isn't he? He's saying, it's okay, just bear with me for a little while, we'll get control, there'll be a vaccine, everything will be fine. Actually, the fact of the matter is very unlikely that it's... I mean, he's also, this is surely it's going to go on forever, this. He says it's not, but surely it is.
Well, more than likely.
Especially if he sees a vaccine as the only solution.
Well, yes, and it may be that they can't get a vaccine for whatever reason. Don't forget that the banking system has collapsed and been bailed out by the Federal Reserve. Far more money's been spent since March last year than was spent in 2008. So most people are freaking out about the COVID and the vaccine, and in actual fact, the banking system's about to collapse, and there's possibly going to be a war with Iran and China. And do you know what? When that happens, we're not going to be worried about vaccines and COVID anymore. We're going to be dealing with fighting in the streets. They're armed to the teeth.
Yeah,
in
well, it's
States.
Interesting, isn't it? Because if that does happen,
with
all those
automatic
civil
weapons,
all those civil liberties that have been taken away, it'd be very handy because the government won't have to be putting up with any protests.
Except in the US, as I've just pointed out, unlike in Northern Ireland where the weapons were all handed over, everybody has got automatic weapons on both sides.
Hang on, the weapons were all handed over. Were they really?
No, apart from a very, very small minority. Okay. The point I'm taking, when in 1969, when the war began in Northern Ireland, the IRA had a few old rifles, rusty old rifles. Eventually, the Libyans supplied them with everything they wanted. But of course, in the US, you don't start from a zero base. Black Lives Matter and the Proud Boys have all got automatic weapons.
Well, we saw the Black Lives Matter parading in a military style in Brixton,
absolutely,
didn't we?
Absolutely. The same sort of thing as the UDA used to do, but the UDA used to do it with broomsticks.
Anyway, Finian Cunningham is on the peace deal speaking now. Ethiopia's Nobel Peace Prize winning Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed did with the dictator of neighbouring Eritrea, with which his country was at war, only to bring Eritrean troops and mercenaries into Ethiopia to kill Ethiopians. Great Prime Minister that. How wonderful to manage to get a Nobel Peace Prize for that. So we're going to hear now from former Fleet Street sub-editor, recently having fled Tigray, where he was living, Finian Cunningham.
Tony, I have to emphasise, this conflict in Tigray is only the latest episode in an ongoing conflict in Ethiopia since he came to power. He's been going around every regional, the nine regions in regional governments in Ethiopia, knocking out incumbent administrations, putting in his own people. And Tigray was the last part of the jigsaw puzzle, which is now being under attack. But this conflict and these rampages have been going on, you know, for ever since he came to power. The thing about the Western media is that they didn't really cover those previous conflicts in other parts of Ethiopia because he won the Nobel Peace Prize, allegedly, you know, making peace. And he got a lot of soft coverage in the likes of the BBC and the American media as Abiy Ahmed, the Nobel Peace Prize winning Prime Minister who's trying to reform Ethiopia. But really what he was doing by reforming was breaking down regional governments, putting in his own central authority in place. And what's going on in Tigray is now the last episode in this whole round of reconstructing Ethiopia.
Fascinating bit of insight from Finian Cunningham, who was living in Tigray until recently. Martin, this is a very interesting thing. I mean, look, so nine different regions in Ethiopia. Tigray is the last one that Abiy Ahmed has been forcing to toe the line, getting rid of elected people in there and putting his own people in charge of Tigray. All the other ones weren't covered by the West because the guy's got a Nobel Peace Prize. So it almost seems to me this whole Nobel Peace Prize thing is a cover story in order to try and deflect criticism away from a guy who's going round and just forcing various regions in his country to toe the line, a little bit like, say, Boris coming down here, you know, either locking up or killing the mayor of Bristol and putting his own person in charge.
Well, the Tigray and the TPLF, the Tigray People's Liberation Front, was at one stage in charge in Addis Ababa. So they were fighting the Derg, they were both Marxist-Leninist organisations, as was the Eritrean People's Liberation Front, and Eritrea eventually broke out of Ethiopia. So don't forget, Ethiopia's a very big place, and you've got the usual problems you've got in Africa. You've got lots of different, basically, ethnic groups subsisting within one state.
What about the propaganda side of it, though? The idea of awarding somebody who's actually taking over regions of his country by force with a Nobel Peace Prize. And actually, that's that just being used a bit like Aung San Suu Kyi. You know, the idea that someone like her, oh, she's a great peacemaker. Actually, what she's doing is she's destroying the country. But it deflects the mass media around the world. All their editors are saying to the journalists, oh, well, we don't really want to have a go at this. They've just won the Nobel Peace Prize.
Well, Obama won the Nobel Peace Prize even when he was at the same stage as Biden is now, just for not being George W. Bush. So, of course, you know, these baubles are given away, provided you are acceptable to the people giving the prize. And, of course, the current government in Ethiopia is more in line with Western, you know, what the Western powers want, you know, and therefore they give them an easy ride. The Africa is becoming a major battleground.
It's not worth the paper it's written on or the metal it's printed on.
It's not just because he's got the Nobel Peace Prize that he's getting support. He got support. Don't forget, there was a terrible civil war in the 80s in Ethiopia. I used to know people who used to go out to Tigray because they were aid workers, used to go out there. And this was the time of the, you know, feed the world and all the rest of it, you know. And, you know, what gradually happened is it settled down and there was supposedly a peace agreement that everybody could live with. And the TPLF at that stage were the main government in Addis Ababa, but they also basically allowed other people, you know, other different ethnic groups to be represented in the government. The guy who's in charge now is an Amhara, which is the main ethnic group, which had traditionally dominated. So, you know, in other words, what's happening here is reversion to type. The dominant ethnic group, which is what Haile Selassie belonged to, are now reasserting their traditional control of the territory of Ethiopia. Although then they seem to have done some kind of deal with the Eritreans, who were the first to break out of Ethiopia, which was very interesting at the time because the Organization of African Unity used to have a rule that we're not going to accept breakaways in any African country, because the borders between the African countries were all drawn by the imperialists, and if we start having breakaways in one country, we're going to have breakaways everywhere, and all of the countries will just break up into warring states. Now, that is still a danger in Ethiopia, and a danger in other parts of Africa. And, you know, it's going to be very, it's very tricky to manage it, even with the best will in the world and under the right circumstances.
Okay, so anyway, look, what's actually going on in Ethiopia on the ground is one thing, but what's probably much more important is the external influences, and that's what I also talked to Finian Cunningham about. And if you want to have a listen to the whole interview, which is about 45 minutes, taking you right through the history of Ethiopia, the ancient history, modern history, and also about what's happening today, you can hear that on our show page. I'll upload that later on this evening at thisweek.org.uk. But for now, we're just going to hear a few minutes on the external influences. Who is really pulling the strings in this new conflict in Ethiopia, which promises, if that's the right word, no it isn't, threatens to become possibly like another Yemen?
No, I think there's an external agenda to break up Ethiopia, to break up its independence, because for all its the faults of before that may have been, it wasn't like, you know, under the coalition government of 30 years led by the TPLF, it was a strong state, strong government. It wasn't, a liberal democracy. But I didn't see any gross violations, or I'm not aware of any gross violations. The one defect, if you like, if you could call it a defect or complaint that the West would have about Ethiopia, was it wasn't open to Western finance. They kept a very independent economic development plan and policy. And in fact, they were very close to China for investment and development. And I think that that's a big factor in why the country's been thrown into turmoil under Abiy Ahmed as a kind of a Trojan horse figure to try to upset, destabilize Ethiopia and bring it kind of to a crashing disruption. And out of the ashes or out of the disruption, the country will be orientated towards Western capital under his so-called stewardship. And I think that's what's going on. Tony, his rise to power is very obscure, is very dodgy. And also the whole thing about him winning the Nobel Peace Prize was a bit of a farce, really. I mean, he won that shortly after becoming the prime minister due to ostensibly a peace deal with Eritrea, a country with which Ethiopia had been having a cold war for 20 years over a border dispute. Now, he gets the Nobel Peace Prize very prematurely, very hurriedly, over an ostensible peace deal, which really, you know, there's not much substance to the peace deal. You know, there's not much actual practical benefit from that peace deal.
What about the strategic position of Ethiopia? You know, you're on the coast of, or in the area of the Northeast Africa, but you're also very close there to the Red Sea and Saudi Arabia and to some other hotspots. What do you think is the strategic significance of Ethiopia?
Well, I think it's huge. You know, it's on the Red Sea, which is a major choke point in global trade, along with the Hormuz Strait and the Malacca Strait. The Red Sea is a major conduit for oil and other commercial trade shipping. It overlooks, you know, the Yemen and the Middle East. It's prime strategic vantage point. Ethiopia itself is landlocked by Eritrea to the north and Djibouti to the north east and Somalia. So it doesn't have access to the Red Sea itself, but it is the location is very tremendously strategically important for its survey of the whole Horn of Africa and, you know, further north Africa. So the Americans have had a security arrangement with the Ethiopian governments down through the years. Even the TPLF-led coalition government were cooperated very closely with the Americans in terms of military counterinsurgency against, you know, Al-Shabaab and various other militants, jihadi militants. Ethiopia was a very strong partner on sort of security issues. But in terms of economic issues, they were more aligned with China. And China saw Ethiopia as its strategic partner, a gateway to the rest of Africa. You know, China got a foothold in Ethiopia, which it did. It would be recommended or, you know, play well for other relations with the other African countries. And I think what's going on here is a move to displace China from this strategic partnership with not only Ethiopia, but other African nations.
The obvious suspect for that is the United States.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, Abiy Ahmed's career path is very dodgy. I mean, before he was a minister in the previous government, which he's now sort of abusing verbally, he was a minister in it. But before that, he was a military intelligence officer. He was a lieutenant in the Ethiopian military intelligence, and he did university studies with a private university that's in the U.S. I'm not sure if he was actually resident in the U.S. for any period of time, but he did a degree in this Ashland University in Ohio. His job being in military intelligence and setting up a national security agency in Ethiopia, the equivalent of the NSA in the States, would have given him a lot of access or contact with the CIA and American intelligence. Now, it's alleged by Ethiopian commentators and political analysts that he was recruited into the CIA years ago, and now he's fulfilling a role on behalf of American imperial interests in Ethiopia by destabilizing the country and then, you know, consolidating power under his rule. You know, it'll make it easier for America to invest in that country, to control the finances of the country and displace China. And this is what's going on.
So that's Finian Cunningham there speaking to me earlier this week. Martin, you know, it's a pretty comprehensive roundup of this being a US proxy war. The guy was over in Abiy Ahmed was over in the United States studying at Ashland University, Ohio, where apparently certain rumours circulating that he would join the CIA, which would have certainly have helped him to set up a national security agency, their version of GCHQ, spying on all communications in Ethiopia.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fairly good summary of where we're at. Africa is becoming a battleground between basically the US, aided by Britain and France, and China and Russia. And this was similar to the 1970s, where at one stage Somalia was aligned with the Soviet Union and Ethiopia was aligned with the West. And then both countries had revolutions and changed sides, and Somalia became aligned with the West and Ethiopia became aligned with the Soviet Union. So, and this is just another replay of those kind of battles. And I'm afraid it's very sad for the people who live in Africa, it always has been, that they are basically, you know, being manipulated by outside forces.
So what you're saying is the end of the Second World War, where the British and various other European powers moved out of Africa, was just a complete farce. Actually, there was just a different type of colonisation, which took over from that and is still going on today with all these bloody consequences. We're hearing today that Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed says the military will begin its final phase of the offensive in the northern Tigray region. His statement came after a 72-hour deadline for the Tigray People's Liberation Front to surrender, and it's expired. The operation was begun on the 4th of November, and he will promising it will come to a quick end, but the TPLF is a formidable fighting force with about 250,000 soldiers. The group is refuting the claim that the federal government is closing in. Phone and internet services have been shut down in Tigray. Media outlets are unable to confirm what's happening on the ground. Of course, all the satellites are seeing everything. Thousands have been killed. Around about 40,000 refugees, though, have been fleeing to neighbouring Sudan. On Wednesday, an Ethiopian news agency said that 10,000 TPLF soldiers had been destroyed in the fighting, but the number has not been verified. So this is an absolute charnel house at the moment. Loads of people being killed, and yet everything's been shut down. No media coverage.
Well, that's because, as you know, COVID is taking up all the oxygen in the room.
It's not that. No, this is because we've got the guy who's designed the communications spying infrastructure in charge as now the Prime Minister. And also he's having help from the Americans. I would wonder also whether with all these mercenaries from Eritrea and elsewhere that you might find some that have been recruited from Al-Qaeda, from Al-Nusra, from ISIS and the rest of these proxy American armies in other parts of the Middle East, like Syria. You know, they kind of run out of steam, been stopped by the Russians, but hang on a minute, hop on this aeroplane, we'll take you somewhere else and you can fight some more for some more money.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the Somalia is more open to that because that's obviously a Muslim country and you've got lots of jihadi influence there. Some of which is definitely being manipulated.
Do these mercenaries really care if they're fighting for Islam or?
Well, no, it depends. They vary, as you can imagine. The motivations for people to go to war.
If you offer them a bit more money, they will go and fight anywhere, won't they?
Well, yes, but I mean, you've got people who have been indoctrinated in the beliefs that they've got and so on. There's a variety of motives for fighting in battles, as you're probably aware. What the TPLF, as you pointed out, they've got a strong guerrilla tradition, so they're just going to disappear into the hills and harass. They're not going, you know, if they've lost 10,000 people, has been suggested, that's because they're going head to head with the Ethiopian army, and they've probably concluded that's a waste of time because they haven't got air superiority or whatever, and they just disappear into the countryside and fight like they did for 30, 40 years previously. So it doesn't solve the problem, but from the Western point of view, they want the various African countries on side for their own needs.
Well, they want the Chinese out.
That's the point I was going to make. They're quite happy to see countries devastated, provided the Chinese don't get a foothold. That's the main concern. So it's not a question of they want to take anything out of Ethiopia particularly. They just don't want the Chinese to get any.
I'm reminded of Dan Glazebrook's book, Divide and Ruin.
Yeah, that's right. So the idea, you see, the way Western imperialism works is that it doesn't necessarily, there are certain places which they're not actually very interested in what goes on there, as long as they're not lined up with the opposition that they want, that they're fighting on a global scale.
Okay, so anyway, that's, well, I have the full version of that interview with Finian Cunningham for anyone that you know, like me. I mean, I get rather fed up when I hear the BBC World Service, etc., talking about Ethiopia with none of the real background involved in there. I don't know why they can't do it, or maybe they're just operating, as George Orwell said, as a propaganda agency. Anyway, we're going to go now to look at the UK a bit more, and I was going through these various movements, Martin, and maybe we'll talk a bit more about Black Lives Matter next week, but I know in the past you've criticised them for being part of a sort of colour revolution type organisation, the idea that you can bring people out onto the streets in order to start unrest and then agitate a government to get some sort of change, or maybe even a coup.
Well, I think that there are genuine people. I mean, I went on the Black Lives Matter demonstration here in Bristol, and it was one of the biggest ones, the biggest one I've ever been on in Bristol. You know, I've been on demonstrations for 20 years around here. And most of those people are not being manipulated directly, but on the other hand, there is also infiltration and manipulation going on in any
movement. So there's two things to say here. First of all, I was amazed to see the Black Lives Matter demonstration advertised on the television 2 days before. So that's on the Thursday evening on the TV, on the local regional news, saying there's this demonstration happening at the weekend if anyone would like to go along, which I've never seen before. So it's not surprising that quite a few people turned up because they knew it was actually happening. One of the problems, of course, is you've got to actually tell people if there's going to be a demo. But the other thing is when organisations are funded, and I'm not sure how Black Lives Matter is funded, then the people who are doing the funding get to pick the people that run the organisation. So they'll say, well, you know, we'll fund you, but only if this person is the treasurer and these people are running it. So, you know, you do wonder how grassroots any organisation is when they're taking that amount of funding.
Yes, and I think what actually happens is you get genuine movements which are created on the hoof, but you've also got intelligence services who are quite, you know, they basically keep an eye on all of these things, and they want to, I mean, we know from the...
They infiltrate them.
They infiltrate
call
everything.
Call a spade a spade. They're in there.
Of course they are, and I mean,
in fact, they might be running it. They may be running.
Yeah, well, indeed,
things.
That's right. So you can't really. I mean, the provisional IRA basically for years had to deal with being infiltrated, and it's eventually turned out that Steak Knife, for example, the head of the internal security operation, was a British Army agent. And of course, they are very well aware of being infiltrated, and they've got all sorts of mechanisms to try and prevent it. They can't prevent it. So Black Lives Matter ain't going to be able to prevent being infiltrated. It's impossible.
No, and also, I mean, I always reminded of Winston Churchill's private secretary, Desmond Morton, and getting to know him as an individual, reading up about him. He was obsessed with coups. He wanted, if he saw an organisation he didn't control, he couldn't sleep at night. So he had to go and, you know, find some way of infiltrating it, taking over and controlling it. But anyway, Heiko Koo, we spoke to last week, who was arrested at the demonstration in Trafalgar Square a few weeks ago. He does this thing at Speaker's Corner every Sunday. And I'll also put a link up, the audio up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk of the rather hilarious speech he gave riding around on his bicycle, haranguing the police, saying how ridiculous they were and how great it was to be able to make fun of them by riding around on a bicycle whilst making a speech, so they couldn't arrest him because he was doing exercise. And that's anyway, but he had a lot to say. Last year, this is, about Extinction Rebellion and where they're coming from. And I think he was kind of preempting the film we were looking at earlier this year, which was called Planet of the Humans, which is looking at all the massive amounts of finance that a lot of the green movement are going along with.
Bill Gates and Melinda Gates, they've got a charitable organisation which promotes the idea of certain technologies that they're selling. There's a lot of, you know, computer apps and all this sort of thing being promoted. And they're trying to create what they call the fourth industrial revolution. But they don't have the capital. And these companies don't want to invest in genuine changes to the environment or changes to their industries that will reduce dangers to the ecology of the planet. And so what they're doing is they're trying to find ways to get revenue out of manipulating popular sentiment around climate change and around environmental pollution and so on. And so it appears, if you look in this article here, It's an article from the Atlantic Council, and there's a lot of US government organizations involved, particular focus around what Al Gore has been promoting for many years. And if you look at this, it says climate finance partnership, mobilizing institutional capital to address the climate opportunity. So it's not about dangers, it's about the opportunity out of climate change. And so what it says here is that there's vast amounts of capital locked up, which in institutions, that means in pension funds basically, and there's calculated that there's $100 trillion locked up in pension funds. That means the pensions paid by all the workers in the shops, all the workers in the world, particularly in the Western world, the United States, Britain and so on, their pension funds are locked up in these institutions. So what they're saying is, by creating a state of mind within the population that there is a desperate and urgent crisis, that we need immediate action, a World War II type mobilization, or a New Deal like Franklin D. Roosevelt introduced in the 1930s to end the Great Depression. We need the most biggest mobilization of resources in the history of mankind. And so they have grassroots movements mobilized by campaigns that they institute, and this is one of the campaigns that have been instituted called Extinction Rebellion. It came about last August, it was created. So the people who come along are genuine, but behind it stand powerful business interests. Now, when I read an article yesterday looking into this question, saying, you know, that these pension fund institutions and big banks and so on are behind it, well, you think, well, can that really be an orchestrated campaign, like a sort of coup d'etat scenario like they're doing in Venezuela, where one thing happens, like, for example, Guaido goes on the streets, declares himself president, has a demonstration, suddenly, out of the blue, Donald Trump supports him, suddenly, out of the blue, the European Union supports, Britain supports, and so on, the Lima group of countries support. So there's an orchestrated series of events, like a media campaign, pre-programmed, pre-planned, strategic operation to change the mind of the population around an issue. And then to get the population saying, we want change, we want change. And then along comes, you look in the newspapers today and yesterday, the BBC reported yesterday, one of the directors of Legal & General, which holds £1 trillion of pension funds in Britain, your money and the population's money in their pensions, they suddenly said there's a desperate emergency and we must do something about it. Then the Bank of England and the Bank of France, the head of the Bank of England, was it Mark Carey or something like that, he released a statement with the head of the Bank of France saying that they must urgently act to on climate change. So here you have people at the centre, and they've got something like 15.3 trillion in funds that they're planning to get released. And so next year there's a meeting in Beijing where it is planned to raise this question, how to unlock the 100 billion, or better said, 90 billion of the 100 billion to be used, you know, your money to be used to promote the fourth industrial revolution. That means the interests of the big companies, Microsoft and all these giant companies, IKEA, Goldman Sachs and so on, how you would release these funds from the population to fund an expansion of their economic activity. Because they're not prepared to fund it themselves, because they're not making enough profits themselves. So they need the government to finance and the people to finance their profitable expansion in the name of fighting climate change. Whereas in actual fact, you know, most of these people, you know, like someone like Al Gore says he's climate neutral, because when he flies around the world in jets, he also pays something for a couple of trees, and therefore he says he's, you know, his carbon footprint is zero. And the other thing they want to do, which is well documented, particularly the World Wildlife Fund being involved in this, is what they call financialization of nature. And so that means, for example, the privatization of jungles, natural forests and so on, in order to say, well, this is a natural resource, if we can say it's this worth this much money, then we can create a global trade in the utilization of nature. And again, it's this type of bubble type of economic activity that they engaged in before the great crash with derivatives derived from mortgages in the past. Now they want to do that with nature. So that's the sort of background that I believe explains what this protest is about. Now, you only have to ask yourself, if there were, there's about 500 people there. If there were 500 young black kids protesting against someone being killed by the police, or if there were, trade unionists protesting, demonstrating, if the workers in Primark came out on strike and demonstrated, they would not be allowed to occupy Marble Arch and Oxford Circus and London and Waterloo Bridge, you know, for days on end without being stopped by the police. Now, the climate protesters have been, they've declared, a lot of them, they're prepared to get arrested. Well, you know, they get arrested and charged with minor offence and then go to, so that creates good publicity as well. So they're being used, you know, their goodwill is being used as cannon fodder to promote this agenda.
So that's Heiko Koo, HEIKOKHOO, who runs the Speaker's Corner show on Resonance FM in London. He also conducts the Marxist tours of London and he speaks at Speaker's Corner on Sundays. In fact, now he's doing it on bicycle because he can't be arrested because he's doing exercise whilst doing his speeches, Martin. But what do you make of that analysis there? He's talking really about the idea of trying to get loads of pension funds to transfer wealth from one way into another using this fourth industrial revolution. Mentioning also the Atlantic Council, the World Wildlife Fund, and the financialisation of nature. So something actually quite big going on behind the scenes, which isn't really being talked about.
Well, when I worked for the New Economics Foundation in the early 90s, I went to a seminar, or just a weekend discussions, with a guy called Aubrey Meyer. And he was the one who was basically a violinist. He wasn't actually got any scientific qualifications. But he was pushing the idea of cap and trade, that we need to cap carbon emissions, and of course that various countries have historically contributed more to carbon emissions than others, you know, Britain, United States obviously being at the top of the list, and that that what we will do is we'll, because of you've poisoned the atmosphere to such an extent, we will give people carbon credits in the developing countries, that is to say the governments in the developing countries, and they can then trade these carbon credits, you know, so that basically they're looking for a market solution to the problem of climate change. And this has been a problem for the Green Movement from the get-go. First of all, the Green Movement was largely ignored. It was regarded as a kind of cranky, freaky, you know, these people eat organic vegetables, you know, they were socially marginal. But over time, they've become more powerful. You know, the Green Party is in government in New Zealand, in Germany, etc. And of course, what happens when you become respectable is that you become controlled. And the big corporations want to control the movement because they want to steer it into avenues which are good for them. And of course, what actually happened about the carbon trading thing was that, to their great credit, Greenpeace, Oxfam, and all the, what I would regard as genuine NGOs said, we're not interested in this. And that, you know, I went to conferences where people would be pushing this carbon trading idea.
Well, you know, it's interesting.
They said, we just don't want to do this.
For example, Oxfam has been severely sanctioned, hasn't it, recently? And they've had all sorts of sting operations and attacks on them because they're not playing ball.
Well, that's because of their stance on what's happening in Palestine. But that's another issue. I think there's always going to be a danger of the Green Movement just becoming a corporate front, just as other movements do. I mean, the same thing happened with the trade union movement historically. You know, you've the Labour Party, whatever. Any movement which is trying to change society has got to deal with outright repression and also just co-optation. And the only way to seriously engage with it, you've got to recognise that is the game. And you've got to be able to recognise when you're being patronised and led along a path.
Okay, basically. Well, back in 2017, do you remember the Paradise Papers? Interesting, one of the key figures in this Great Reset, apparently a great environmentalist, lives down the road from here at Highgrove in Gloucestershire near Tetbury. Prince Charles lobbied on climate policy after a purchase of shares, says the BBC in November 2017. Prince Charles campaigned to alter climate change agreements without disclosing his private estate has an offshore financial interest in what he was promoting. Paradise Papers show that the Duchy of Cornwall secretly bought shares worth $113,000 in a Bermuda company that's benefiting from a rule change The prince was a friend of a director of Sustainable Forestry Management Limited too. The Duchy of Cornwall said he's no direct involvement in his investments. So Prince Charles is actually gaining from these carbon markets, which he's also now pushing with the Great Reset, Martin.
Yeah, it wouldn't be at all surprising, would it? I mean, this is the way the world operates. And, you know, people have just got to have, you know, what does this pass the smell test? And you see, there was a big debate in the German Green Party in the 1980s and 1990s between what they call the Realos and the Fundies. The Fundies wanted to stick to very, you know, pure green principles and, you know, various, you know, for example, not having an agreed leader and this sort of thing. And the Realos wanted to be part of the power structure. And that's obviously going to be a tension in any political movement. You've still got Irish Republican dissidents who won't accept the peace agreement. Nevertheless, the mainstream Irish Republican movement has decided to go respectable, if you like. So this tension is going to be there in any political movement. And that doesn't mean that the people involved on the ground, I mean, a lot of the, you know, when new movements grow up, like Black Lives Matter, I spoke to some of the organisers of the Black Lives Matter protest here in Bristol. They split almost immediately, by the way. There were two different groups in competition with each other. This also happens. They were having different competing demonstrations. And most of those people, when I talked to them about this kind of topic, were aware of it, but not as aware of it as they might be. They'd basically just joined the movement because they'd seen it on Facebook, and you could say, well, they were quite genuine in their commitment to it. But that doesn't mean that you're not being manipulated, because of course the Democrats have used Black Lives Matter in the US as a means of getting Biden elected. That's what their only interest in it, frankly. And that, you know, a lot of the militants involved have basically inevitably been drawn
campaign. Isn't it interesting the way that the killing, the murder of George Floyd, you know, being filmed and everything, came at a perfect time to influence the US election?
Well, you could argue that, and I think you need to analyse these things very carefully. Don't forget that the teenager who filmed it on her phone was 17 years old, and she happened to film it. So sometimes, don't forget, police killing unarmed black people in the US happens every day. It has been going on for years. It doesn't take much as long as somebody's got a smartphone, then you can film it. That doesn't mean that it's not manipulated once it gets going.
Well, the other thing about Extinction Rebellion is it's very interesting. I found it very interesting to see that they put out a statement condemning the organisers of a anti-lockdown protest in Stroud. So although they want the right to protest themselves, and they actually get the right to take over most of some large areas of central London without any harassment by the police, they themselves are condemning people who are gathering social distance in the park, Stratford Park in Stroud, about 3 weeks ago, led by a woman called Debbie, and that they were condemning that. So isn't it strange? They seem actually to fit in with all these, you know, Boris guidelines. Oh dear, there's a lockdown going on, no demonstrating please.
Well, the truth of the matter is that there are different views about all of these things. And
not in Extinction Rebellion and in Stroud there isn't. They are being roundly condemned. So it's interesting, I think, when one protest group goes so far as to say another protest group shouldn't have the right to protest and starts to condemn them. I mean, that to me sounds
suspicious. That's because they're
suspicious.
Not necessarily on the same
it's
side.
Competition, you know.
Yeah, well, it's competition.
Sort. Surely, I mean, any genuine protest group is fighting for the right to protest generally, aren't they?
No, well, if you look in Northern Ireland, there are two communities, and they have different demonstrations. And
these aren't religions, are they?
Or, no, they're political positions, yeah? And they don't, in fact, support each other's right to demonstrate generally. You know, so the Orange Lodges want to march down the Gavaki Road, which is a mainly Catholic road, and the police try
and
block them.
Let's hope it doesn't come to the Orange Lodges versus the IRA Stroud. That would be rather
upsetting.
Well, I know,
but I mean, the problems are there. In the United States, you've had demonstrators and counter-demonstrators. The Black Lives Matter people on the one side and the Proud Boys and what have you on the other
side.
So the potential for conflict is always there, like in Tigray.
One of the four main aspects of the anti-lockdown protests, which are continuing, obviously, during these tiered measures, so I don't know whether the law is going to change to allow people to actually have distance protests without the police ramming everybody together so that they're spreading the virus, is something called Event 202, Event 202 is the brainchild of a chap called allegedly Dave, who's been speaking here in Bristol at the Stand Up X protests, for example. And it initially started with a 3.5-hour pandemic avoidance tabletop exercise that stimulated a series of scenario-based facilitated discussions confronting difficult true-to-life dilemmas associated with a made-up pandemic driven by media-induced fear, a false flag pandemic event. So in a way, Martin, this is mimicking the reversal, in a way, of Event 201, which was created by Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the John Hopkins University, where they recruited the best three thinkers, critical thinkers and researchers to do something similar, but almost looking at it the other way around. Event 202 is a way to avoid as much damage to society from a pandemic.
Well, I think a lot of this goes back to Dark Winter, which was a war game that was conducted before 9/11 about anthrax attacks on the United States. And a lot of the personnel involved in that are very much involved in these later and pandemic meetings like Event 201. I think that the whole thing is a biological warfare attack plus a psychological warfare operation.
Wasn't it interesting that Event 201 took place almost at exactly the same time as those military world games in Wuhan, where yes. the Americans were over there, yeah. possibly dangling their little files of coronavirus? Well,
several people from the US delegation were hospitalized for flu-like symptoms in Wuhan at those military games. And don't forget, the Times of Israel informs us that the Israeli Defense Forces were told in November last year, this time last year, that was a pandemic coming out.
Anyway, I've lost count of the number
that
of people.
That suggests that they knew what was going to happen, doesn't it?
I've lost count of the number of people I've spoken to that feel like they, either in November or December last year, here in Bristol and the surrounding area, that they had COVID before it was even supposed to exist, well, if you go by the symptoms.
On that point, in actual fact, the Italians... it seems there's quite a big suggestion that it in fact started in Italy and that it went to China indirectly, but it may, of course, come out of Fort Detrick in June last year, because
you know
they
what?
Closed Fort Detrick because what had happened you nearby, people got COVID symptoms in local communities, and Fort Detrick, which is their version of Porton Down, was then closed,
you
although
know,
they won't say why.
You know, I would suggest most likely Porton Down. I hate to say it, but... You know, that's the one I think was where there's so much secrecy going on there. And also, I mean, we interviewed Steve Brody from Points West, who's retired now, but his explanation of the horrors down there and the absolute secrecy around biological weapons was absolutely unbelievable. Anyway, we'll finish tonight by listening to Simone Marshall from Event 202. She's been working with allegedly Dave and others on this whole campaign around the country, and they certainly aren't taking any notice whatsoever of rules or guidelines saying that you can't have any protests during the lockdown, because that's exactly what they're protesting against.
My friend died. My friend died in April. He was 60 years of age. He had no underlying health conditions. He walked into Charing Cross Hospital with a urinary tract infection at the beginning of this lockdown in March to pick up some medication, which he would usually take, some antibiotics. And he was told that they would test him if he wanted to. He'd been traveling on the underground, and so he said, yeah, sure. Now, at that time, we didn't know anything about the virus. We weren't told a lot. There were all different kinds of reports. And they, within hours, they purportedly came back with a test that was positive and said, oh, we're going to keep you in, even though he presented no symptoms. He was fit and healthy. And he got scared and he decided to listen to their advice and stay in. Within 3 days, he had been shoved onto a ventilator and he was dead within 3 weeks. They didn't tell him to go home and isolate. He lives on his own. He wasn't told to go and dose up with vitamin D and look after yourself. He wasn't told, I don't know, he wasn't sent away with any hydroxychloroquine. I can never say that word. No, he was told to stay in, and they put him on a ventilator. And anyone who is a health professional out there knows that ventilators are last resort. And we know that there was statistics coming out during this lockdown that over 80% of people that are put on ventilators die. Tony, I'm not being funny, but when every year there's a flu bug that goes around, and every year it's slightly different to the next one. Every time I get flu, it's never the same. One time it's in my head, the next time it's on my chest, the next time I don't feel any of that. I'm just sweating and I've got a massive temperature. Every time it's different, right? I go to the doctor and I say, I'm really struggling here. Can you give me something? The doctor almost certainly always 100% turns around and says, you know what, Miss Marshall, you've got the flu. There's nothing I can do for you. Go home and rest. They don't tell me to go and put on a mask and stay 6 feet from someone and go and shut my business and keep myself isolated for 14 days. No, you just be sensible. You go home, you wrap up, you make sure you feed yourself well and dose up on vitamin C. You know, the world has gone nuts. There is enough medical practitioners, scientists, virologists, immunologists out there now, all disagreeing with the government narrative and coming against it and saying it's nothing more than the worse than the annual flu. People need to wise up. The government need to back off. Okay. So for anyone who's perpetuating this and saying they're deeply offended, I am deeply offended. I'm deeply offended that this lie is being able to be maintained by those same people.
Okay, so what do you think is really going on then? Obviously, there's something else happening if it's not a pandemic.
Well, look, the hospitals were incentivized to put people on ventilators. The hospital are incentivized to put... local authorities are incentivized to put people in lockdown, for flip's sake. Doctors are being incentivized to give people the jab. It all works on money. It all works on profit. It all works on this incentivization. And if you don't hit your targets and if you don't hit this many, then we will take this funding away from you and that funding away from you. And it's presented in such a way, it's like coercion. Because this is what it all operates on. It's all fear-based, and it's not looking at the actual underlying issues or the root concerns of somebody. It's only treating symptoms. You know, shoving everybody on all the old people on a DNR, do not resuscitate. Is that really protecting the vulnerable?
No. No, it's definitely not protecting the vulnerable by putting on people on do not resuscitate and locking them away in care homes, private care homes, where the family can't keep an eye on how they're being looked after. Definitely not. Anyway, Simone finished by telling me about what she thinks businesses should do, because, of course, this is, as I said earlier, it's been extremely good for big companies like Amazon, Facebook, and, funnily enough, Bill Gates' Microsoft. But what about small businesses?
Everybody needs to just get back, open their businesses. The more people that open their businesses, they need to come together in little business networks. I mean, we've got our own business network growing. We've got about 1,700 people in the group now. I'm going to say out of that, you've got at least 1,500 businesses all coming together, learning and educating themselves with the rights or their rights, constitutional rights, and they're going to be taking action together, because, you know, part of the reason why people don't open their businesses as much as they want to is because of the fear that they're going to get these notices, these fraudulent, frivolous orders and notices against them, which is going to cost them money, these fines. It's just another way to tax the people, another way to extort from them. No, every business has the right to run its business as it so wishes, without any, free from any government interference. And the same, you know, these are civil matters. The police should not be getting involved in civil matters.
I think it's fascinating how, so that's Simone Marshall from Event 202. The website for them is just event202.org. And, Martin, you know, there have been some businesses putting up some sort of so-called resistance here in Bristol, but they seem to be going down this route of common law, where they say things like, oh, we put a big sign saying with Magna Carta on the door, and a common law warning. And this, the, authorities seem to lap that up. They sort of go, okay, great. Well, they're going down this route, which is not conventional law. And we've got them.
Well, they have, because, of course, the law is the law, and it's actually made by vested interests. And the idea that you've got some human rights that go back to Magna Carta, tell that to the people who were shot down on Bloody Sunday. They didn't. They could have said, oh, we've got common law here, the army can't shoot us, but they did, because they can.
time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest in the first hour and in the second hour and in the third hour, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. Also to studio engineer and sound recordist Dave Bazanko, and also to Robert Hansen, live over in Hong Kong in the early hours of the morning there. Download our MP3s and you can listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find this show's podcast, story links, comment page and our contact details out this week. oneword.org.uk. I'm Shadow Band on Twitter at Tony Gosling. You'll find me there. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable PRSC weekend. This show is repeated after this show and again at midnight on Friday on the PRSC stream and over Sunday lunch in two places, from noon at richieallen.co.uk and also at camberleysradioqUK.com. Do please feel free to download and rebroadcast this show anywhere you like, but do credit the show to thisweek.org.uk. And if you'd like to hear what our Tory Labour Mayor Marvin Rees is up to, you can tune in to BCFM boss Pat Hart around 8 a.m. every Wednesday morning, where they have their cosy chit-chat. And if that makes you angry, you can request this show's reinstatement on BCFM. You'll find links on our contact tab at our show page, thisweek.org.uk. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless. And don't let the banksters get you down.
Del quinto centenario.
Straight in at number three on the DJ's choice, and most of the tracks in the charts are upbeat house records, and it's no real surprise because, as we know, Amsterdam is house nation of the world.